Did you ever hear of a thing called the Nagda Niederlage?
No, what's that?
It was the last will and testament of the Third Reich. Orders for the procedure after the defeat.
When they saw the end coming, a few Nazis in high places were entrusted with the job of hiding the party's loot from the Allies. Instructions were to go underground until the occupation forces withdrew. After that, the booty was to be used for the reorganization of the Nazi Party in Germany.
The loot was gold, millions of dollars worth of it. Some of it was melted down from church vessels and objects of art, but most of it came from the hands and the mouths of victims of concentration camps. Wedding rings and dental work. This is the sort of booty the Nazi big shots were dealing in.
We know there is an organization controlling the remaining treasure in Germany today. And we think the man behind it is the same man who directs the Silhouette operation.
It's Friday. It's five or a minute after five. And welcome to the COVID Secure, not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 1st of October, 2021. We're dreaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. So, tonight, criminal gangs in the police. We have a special feature tonight looking at criminality. On the Wayne Cousins sentencing week, and further revelations about how horrific this particular Metropolitan Police officer was. But the problems are in the Metropolitan Police and in South Wales particularly, as we will be hearing tonight. The case of Police Constable Tony Roach, a Cardiff cop sacked for stopping criminals in Cardiff, and on the testimony of two known criminals. That's why he was sacked as a police officer. And the Barry Mafia, alleged sex abuse by a Belgian company, DEME, D-E-M-E, part of something called the New Waves Solution. They are dredging the Hinkley Mud in the Channel, Bristol Channel, and taking it over to Cardiff. And it's a very controversial project, part of the Hinkley Sea White Elephant. And they are, apparently, managers there are abusing the staff. So we'll be hearing from one of them, a whistleblower, in a minute. Wayne Cousins, obviously, that's the main story of this week. Probably one of the worst, if not the worst, cases of a police officer, a criminal, and murdering somebody and raping them. And also, he came straight from the US embassy. This is something which many of the news reports skip over. He'd been working that day at the US embassy as a police officer. And then he went straight from there to the S&M murder of Sarah Everard. Also this week, finally, we will wind up with a little bit about COVID, which is ivermectin in Peru. The secrets around the success of ivermectin. In fact, it's so successful that the data analyst that's shown how successful it is, Juan Chamis, has been suspended from Twitter, even though what he's been publishing is just verified facts and graphs to show that ivermectin is, let's stress this, is a fantastic treatment for COVID, but it's being censored because the emergency use authorization, which enables these emergency vaccines to be tested on the general public, some, you know, 80%, 90%, some countries have had people have these injections now, relies on and requires no alternative treatment to be available. Clearly there is alternative treatment. It's called ivermectin. And for pointing that out, Juan Chamis has been sacked from Twitter. But first, we'll be looking at the Labour conference. This is the politics show, after all. That is to say, the real Labour conference and also the DVLA crisis. And Insulate Britain, we'll be talking to, we'll be hearing from anyway, literally yesterday is when he finally found out that he's got a distinction in his PhD from the Centre of Alternative Technology. No, sorry, I think it's an MSc, actually, in environmental science, looking at insulation, funnily enough. And Insulate Britain, apparently, don't know what they're talking about. In fact, they don't know anything about insulation. Of course, that's because, partly because this is just a cover for XR, Extinction Rebellion, and they want to call themselves something else in order to keep the preserve the brand of XR. Many and many reasons. We'll be hearing from Kerry about the reasons why what they're doing is just ridiculous. And Kerry and I both go back to the old road protest of Newbury, etc., looking at real environmentalism versus this kind of fake version from XR. And also Greta Thunberg, blah, blah, blah. But her big speech this week. But will the COP26 in Glasgow get President Xi and Macron and these big guns? Because the British seem to be actually alienating the Chinese and the French as much as they can. Also to do with the Labour conference, we'll be hearing some speeches from the real leader, Keir Starmer, and the ex-leader, Jeremy Corbyn, in contrasting. Martin Summers and I will be contrasting what their approaches are, because Jeremy gave a speech in Liverpool a few weeks ago, which addresses some of the issues which were missing from Keir Starmer's great speech on Wednesday this week at the Labour Party's annual conference. And looking delving deeper into real Labour and the real left, we've got a fascinating chat anyway with historians from Wellingborough. They are the Wellingborough Independent Socialists, Paul Crofts and Richard Jacks, actually at the site of the diggers back in the English Civil War over in Wellingborough, which the left wing in that part of the country very much remember. Finally, South East Rail collapses, £25 million of fraud. And what the reason was for that was that they were not running trains that were cancelled, etc. They're supposed to pay compensation for that, but they never did because they just forgot to tell us, that is the government. And so they ended up defrauding the British taxpayer of £25 million, so they're out too. Censorship and self-censorship of life-saving information is sadly the norm in Britain today, thanks to the big pharma globalist collaborators who own the transmitter rates and the cartel-run printing presses of the Fourth Industrial Revolution's Fourth Reich. So if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and we'll credit you here. So joining me is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Martin, this is the Labour Party conference this week, but you don't, as even though you're a member still, amazingly, and I do wonder sometimes how you manage to stay in with some of the... you do actually criticise Israel, but you've managed to stay a Labour member. How do you do it?
I don't use social media, Tony.
Okay. Well, that's a very simple way to do it.
And what we say on here is only listened to by a select few.
That's right.
And certainly not Labour Party regional officials.
That's right. And if you do an internet search for you, actually it's quite difficult to find you saying anything incriminating, isn't it?
Well, yes.
Even if it is, I mean, it's awful, isn't it, that we use this word incriminating. It does sound a little bit McCarthyite.
Well, it is. I mean, obviously, you know, we could delve into the deep mind that is the anti-Semitism charade in the Labour Party, but I imagine we need to concentrate on, you know, other things to keep the show bubbling along.
Well, why? What do you mean?
Well, I mean, what do we want to talk about the conference as a whole, or do we just want to talk about
anti-Semitism? What's your impressions of it? I imagine you've been following it.
I've been following it, yeah. Obviously, as we said last week, there were two conferences, as it were. There was the official conference, and there was this sort of alternative fringe conference, which has to a certain extent happened every year for years, but the alternative fringe is probably bigger this year than previously because it's a lot more organisation as a result of the Corbyn era. Starmer basically made some pretty bad calls. I mean, the idea to try and change the electoral system for the leadership and then failing.
Well, no, he did change it, didn't he?
Yeah,
he
didn't. He didn't get what he wanted.
Hang on, yes, but look, let's be clear about this, because Jeremy Corbyn only just about got enough MPs to sponsor him to be able to stand for leader, and now the rules have been changed, so he wouldn't be able to do that next time.
That's true, but at the same time, Starmer was going for broke by trying to bring back the old system where there would be three electoral colleges, which would have
equal... Was that under Kinnock, that one?
Well, it was changed by Ed Miliband. Ed Miliband won under the previous setup, where there were three separate electoral colleges for unions, constituency parties, and I think it's affiliated.
I seem to remember in the doldrums days with the Thatcher government that there was this electoral college system. It didn't really seem to work.
Well, the electoral college system is ancient. the internal structures of the Labour Party are quite complicated because they were created over a century ago and have never been updated until recently, where you ended up with this one person, one vote election.
I mean, it seems
which led to Corbyn's election.
Pretty obvious what's going on, because MPs like Chris Williamson, who might have voted for an alternative left candidate had they been allowed to stay in the Labour Party, have been booted out.
That's true, but at the same time, even more fundamentally, what Starmer wanted to do was to get rid of one person, one vote. He then tried to push this past the unions, and he thought the unions would buy into this because they would get their old role of you know, basically having one chunk of the votes just for them. But the unions had
a little bribe, maybe.
Well, no, but the point is he hadn't consulted the trade unions. And the trade unions basically didn't want it. And if he'd consulted them, they'd have said, don't even try. So the thing what Starmer got wrong there, even from his own point of view, is if you want to push something like that through, you've got to sound people out and make sure you've got the votes before you even bring it forward.
I stress, it up from 10% to 20% of MPs. So you've got to have 20% of MPs
won that? He won that because Unison, my union, voted for his proposals, whereas other unions did not. Now, in other words, what he's done is he's tried to get something done. He's got some of it done and some of it not done. But in any case, from the point of view of not just the left, but in general, there is not much mileage in the country at large for arcane arguments about how the Labour Party elects its leader.
Well, there is, because what's happening here is an attempt, well, it's a successful attempt to stop something like Jeremy Corbyn happening in the future.
It's definitely an attempt to stop something like that happening in the future, but it hasn't fully succeeded. And the other point I would make is that at this time, what Starmer is flagging up is, because I think I'm going to lose the next election, I'm now trying to fix the next election for the leadership of the Labour Party so that the left can't win after I've lost the election. Now, that is a pretty poor pitch, both to the Labour Party and to the country. What he should have been doing is attacking the Tories. If he wants to change this stuff, he could then change it. If he wins the election, he'd be in a strong position to try and change the internal rules of the Labour Party.
But I mean, really what's going on here is also that the Labour Party internal apparatchiks and procedures, they know that they can make sure that people only get a chance to vote for a right-wing Labour candidate, and they're making sure that all the left candidates just simply don't get a chance to stand.
That's right.
For example, here in Bristol.
Well, that's true, and of course it's not helped by the fact that loads of people who joined the party to vote for Corbyn have now left the party. But of course that makes their job easier. And the Labour Party has always been, if you look at the history, a bit of a bun fight between the left and the right.
Now,
going back to the 1950s, so it's hardly really new.
Well, I mean,
they're still at daggers draw.
Now what's happened is, because of Corbyn's failure to do this and get rid of the right-wing people, all the activists, etc. What about the role of Peter Mandelson? Because, you know, Lord Mandelson is a very... I've been sent some fascinating information, which I'll share up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, about Peter Mandelson this week. It's actually already up on the 9/11 forum, if people want to have a look at it there straight away. That is 911forum.org.uk, but I'll put it on this week's show page too. It's really a timeline of Mandelson's involvement right back to being best buddies with Ted Heath back in the 1970s.
Ted Heath,
going to concerts and things like that with Ted Heath.
I mean
maybe he was just trying to lobby the Tories.
Well,
at
I mean, the,
time.
The thing, Mandelson actually went to my college, St Catherine's, and he was there before I was there, and he was known even then to be a social climber. So,
isn't it? What has he said about being filthy rich? He feels
he said he was extremely relaxed about people being filthy rich.
Yeah, which doesn't sound very Labour.
No, but of course, what he's trying to do is spin. Don't forget, he is Labour aristocracy in the old sense of the term. In that his grandfather was Herbert Morrison, who was head of the GLC and a very, you know, Fabian of great note and all the rest of it. So somebody like Mandelson regards being a leader of the Labour Party as a kind of, you know,
we've got the
birthright,
similar thing,
really.
I know, we've got a similar thing going on with David Miliband, haven't we? These old Labour families seem to have turned rather nasty actually turned a bit blue.
Well, they are the people who see the party as, to a certain extent, a personal possession. And of course, he was very much not flavour of the month during the Corbyn era, although he didn't, you know, he carried
he spent
on sniping
well, you
from
say
the
that,
sidelines.
But he was, well, it wasn't just that. He was actually actively trying to get Jeremy Corbyn out and trying to help him lose the election so he couldn't continue.
Yes, well, I mean,
and he's within the party, and yet he is still in the party, Mandelson.
Yes.
Amazing, really.
Yes, it is. Well, I mean, this is, you know, this has been the the situation in the Labour Party since, you know, the Stone Age almost.
Okay, well, what
so
an opposition.
Not a lot has actually changed. I mean, during the Corbyn era, there was a sense that perhaps the Labour Party is going to change fundamentally, but the fundamental problems still remain, which are ultimately to do, as I've always suggested, with the electoral system.
Well, I don't know about that. I think it's actually internal. Within the Labour Party, Martin. You always talk about the system.
In Germany, where there's just been an election, which we haven't mentioned, the left have won because you've got three separate parties. You've got the Green Party, you've got the Social Democrats, and you've got the Links Party. And they're three separate parties, and because of the system, they have won the election.
But hasn't the Labour Party just been infiltrated by the right?
No. The Labour Party has been not infiltrated by the right. There's always been a right wing in the Labour Party. They're a legitimate political tendency, just as the left wing are a legitimate political tendency, but we're forced to be in the same party by first place.
We actually, to a certain extent,
of course,
in
the
this
Labour
country,
Party doesn't stand in Northern Ireland, where they do have proportional
elections.
Well,
or Scotland, hardly. But anyway,
no, the Scotland is going
exactly
that way. It's
wiped out, you know. But I mean, it's almost like a one-party state now.
It is indeed, and of course they're going to gerrymander the constituencies. They're going to make it difficult for people without ID to vote, and of course the next election,
which means the poor, doesn't it?
That means the poor, basically. And of course they've actually got an 80-seat majority with 43% of the vote, which wouldn't be acceptable in any other European country. And of course they're probably going to get an even bigger majority with a smaller percentage of the vote at the next election. Maybe we need to start planting bombs, Tony. What do you think?
No, I don't think so. And that's an idiotic thing to say.
No. Well, ultimately, when you've got an unfair system, do you see what's happened in Belarus this week?
What also should
the police just shot somebody dead, but he shot back and killed
Martin,
one of the police.
Martin, you're being extremely provocative here. Actually, what's happened
is
Jeremy Corbyn has failed to actually do what he was supposed to do, which was to try and bring the party round to becoming more of an old fashioned Labour Party again. Anyway, look, you know, you and your provocations, it's just, you know, it's really irritating.
I'm pointing out to you, Tony,
there are problems with the system.
The issues with the system are fundamental.
They're not, because Corbyn failed to put to the electorate a winning strategy in the last election, and he's actually handed this massive majority over to the Tories.
Well, I don't agree with that.
Well, I know you don't.
So let's just leave
because
it
you
at
were
that.
Part of the reason that he did come out with all that sort of anti-EU, anti-Brexit after the vote. I mean, you know, he lost loads and loads of constituencies
we know your position that Corbyn, if he'd come out in favour of Brexit, would have won the election.
That's quite possibly. Yeah.
No, he wouldn't. It's just wrong.
Well, okay, we can just agree to disagree. Anyway, let's hear from Keir Starmer now, because we're going to be hearing actually from Jeremy Corbyn after this.
Before I start, let me tackle the issue of the day head on. If you go outside and walk along the seafront, it won't be long before you get to a petrol station that's got no fuel. Level up, you can't even fill up. And conference, doesn't that just tell you everything you need to know about this government? Ignoring the problem, blaming someone else, then coming up with a half-baked solution. Prime Minister, either get a grip or get out of the way and let us step up and clear up this mess. Conference, it's easy to comfort yourself that your opponents are bad people. I don't think Boris Johnson is a bad man. I think he's a trivial man. I think he's a showman. He's a showman with nothing left to show. He's a trickster who's performed his one trick. Once he'd said the words, get Brexit done, his plan ran out. There is no plan. At this time on a Wednesday, it's normally the Tories that are heckling me. Doesn't bother me then. Won't bother me now. The questions we face in Britain today are big ones. How we emerge from the biggest pandemic in a century. How we make our living in a competitive world. The climate crisis. Our relationship with Europe. The future of our union. These are big issues. But our politics is so small. These times demand a responsible leader with clear values.
Where's Peter Mandelson?
From my dad, I understand the dignity of work. From my mum, I appreciate the nobility of care. From my work, the principle that we are all equal before the law. Shouting slogans or changing lives conference. One of the urgent needs of our time is mental health. Labour will guarantee that support will be available in less than a month. Labour will make Britain a world leader in science and research and development. And we will set a target to invest a minimum of 3% of GDP. Under my leadership, Labour will be back in business. And let me give you an example of how this template can work. Let's take the hardest question and the biggest issue of our time. Climate change. This is an issue of security. It's a test of justice on a global scale. Climate change poses an existential threat. It will turn fertile terrain into desert land. Conflicts will break out over scarce resources like water. Millions will be displaced by flooding, forest fires, and violent storms. Time is short, and we have a duty to act. But that obligation shouldn't daunt us. It should embolden us. Shifting the economy onto a sustainable path is full of promise for Britain. Full of promise. The SNP and the Tories walk in lockstep. They both exploit the constitutional divide for their own ends. Labour is the party that wants to bring our nations together.
So Keir Starmer speaking on Wednesday at the Labour conference, his big keynote speech, Martin, but no mention of human rights, no mention of Palestine, no mention of Julian Assange, no mention of racism, Black Lives Matter, or any of NATO's wars. A lot of things seem to be missing from that speech, the traditional Labour territory and certainly Corbyn territory.
Well, yes. I mean, there's
an hour and a half as well.
Well, there's an hour and a half speech, and even that section we've had has
covered just quite a few clips.
Yeah, that's obviously cherry picked from the whole speech. Well, it's, you know, some of that stuff is what you might expect him to say. Most of it I agree with, but at the same time, the question is, you know, what's the strategy underlying all of this? I mean, telling the SNP that they're going to lose in Scotland, the Labour Party has been wiped out in Scotland. They're not coming back
to
the speech like that.
It's the sort of level of fantasy we got from the Lib Dems saying that they were preparing for government at the last election.
Well, as I said earlier, by prioritising trying to change the elections for Labour leadership, he's basically flagged up that he doesn't expect to win the next election. And that's a dead giveaway. He shouldn't have done that. Basically, he could have ignored that, and then his speech would have been on a firmer basis. And, of course, he's being heckled precisely because he's deliberately provoked the left, and therefore they're heckling him, which then, of course, comes across either as... Some people will say that makes him look strong when he's dealing with hecklers. I would suggest that it's probably a bad... You know, it doesn't do the party any good for, you know, the leader to be heckled like that. But, I mean, he's provoked it, and therefore... And he's even wanted people to heckle him. He's encouraged this kind of thing, you know. So he's ended up alienating his core support. supporters, but will he be able to win any people over on the right?
When it comes across as a bit,
and the answer is probably not.
It comes across as a bit shambolic, especially when he doesn't seem to have very good comebacks for people doing the heckling. Anyway, an important article this week from the Squawk Box, an important bit of coverage, I think. Starmer's beauty of work used in his main speech. We didn't hear that particular bit, but he certainly used it in his speech on Wednesday, was a Nazi propaganda slogan, the Squawk Box is pointing out this week. During his conference speech today, they wrote on Wednesday, summarised by one wag as spend 17 years getting ready for work and learning to follow the rules, and then the rest of your life working and following the rules. Keir Starmer quoted the beauty of work as a driving force for what passes for his vision for Britain. Starmer attributed his idea to W.H. Auden, but in fact the beauty of work, Schönheit der Arbeit, was a slogan of a propaganda department of the Nazis from 1934 to 1945. And they rather cleverly have got an image as part of this article, which I'll share up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, of a sort of giant mechanical wheel with a swastika in the middle of it. And these slogans clearly aren't Nazi slogans. Along with its sister organisation, Strength Through Joy, the Squawk Box continues, which promoted large families to secure Aryan domination. The SDA aimed to keep the population in what its rulers considered their place. Not ideas you'd hope to find in the head of a Labour leader, but Keir Starmer is neither Labour nor a leader in any meaningful sense of those words. And with his speech today, stage managed to hide the sparse attendance, and the audience literally policed by the Met's armed response unit to intimidate dissenters, the source of those ideas might well approve. Anyway, it's an interesting article and fascinating that they've actually got a picture of this Nazi thing, Martin. Not beauty of work, it's not necessarily, it's almost like the work makes you free, Arbeit macht frei, that was outside Auschwitz, isn't it?
It is, but it's also so vacuous that virtually anybody could come out with it and it doesn't mean anything. That's the problem.
The trouble with beauty of work is that many people are working now, but they're not actually making enough money in order to pay the rent and the various bills. So they're ending up with having done a week's work and then finding that actually they don't have any money to spend on leisure activities or on kids or whatever.
Well, indeed. So in other words, the beauty of work is a vacuous slogan. It's the sort of thing that William Morris might have come up with. We're not going to have workers working in factories. They're all going to be craftspeople making handmade things. And of course,
I think William Morris is a little bit, below
the belt
on
thing,
Morris.
That's the sort of thing that he talked about. And of course, eventually, he set up these various rather successful businesses where craftspeople made beautiful things and sold them to very, very wealthy people because poor people couldn't afford them.
Okay, so let's have a listen now to the sort of alternative, I suppose it was, a couple of weeks ago. 14th of September, this speech in Liverpool by the former leader, Jeremy Corbyn, and compare and contrast.
I want to help the people of Yemen. I want our overseas aid to help the people of Yemen to deal with cholera, with water supply, with health conditions, with education, and all those things. But I don't want to be part of the problem that bombed and destroyed them in the first place. So, in that campaign, let us remember all of those things. And remember that wars are easy to start and hard to stop. 9/11 was a disastrous day. Those thousands that died in New York, in the World Trade Center, didn't deserve to die. It was horrendous, it was wrong, and it was terrible. Just as much as those 7,000 that were killed by General Pinochet after the coup on 9/11/1973. And so, after 9/11 in New York, George Bush gave himself total powers. Only one member of Congress voted against it. The wonderful, wonderful woman who represents Oakland in California, Barbara Lee, was the only one. She said in all conscience she could not vote to start another war. And she was right. And we then voted, well, at least I didn't, but a lot of MPs did, that we would send our troops to Afghanistan Here we are, all these years later, thousands of Afghan people have died. Desperate refugees now trying to get out, and they should be allowed out, and they should be made welcome in this country, and they should be supported. Thousands of American troops died, 457 British troops died, and more than a million Afghans are refugees in neighboring countries and other parts of the world. The war in Iraq, which we opposed, the 2 million of us that went to London that day to oppose it, said it won't solve the problems of Iraq, it will cause the wars and the terrorism and the refugee crises of tomorrow. It's this refugee crisis the world faces. 70 million people are refugees, in part caused by the wars. They're people who deserve to live. They're people who want to make their contribution. So I'm ashamed when the British government, on the one hand, says it's welcoming Afghan refugees, good if they were doing that, and then at the same time tries to push legislation through our parliament which makes it a criminal offence to save somebody's life in the English Channel and push them back rather than coming to our shores. The human instinct is to save life, not condemn those that bring about safety for others.
Okay, so that's a contrasting speech by Jeremy Corbyn, Martin. Much more of the emphasis on foreign policy, very, very little from Keir Starmer about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're two different speeches for different audiences, and that's a brilliant speech by Jeremy Corbyn as the chair of Stop the War, which, of course, is what he was for many years, apart from the fact that he thinks 9/11 was carried out by the Afghans.
Well, I think Keir Starmer does too.
Well, I'm sure he does. Now, well, Keir Starmer thinks
whatever he's told to think about.
Well,
that.
I mean, Keir Starmer, you can imagine, is an establishment person, and he will hold establishment views about many of these things. Now, don't forget that Starmer's got a different speech to make for a different audience, and don't forget Starmer's audience is really the TV audience that are watching. And trying to assess him as a potential prime minister.
But why is he being heckled? He should have a friendly audience there.
Well, the reason I suggested earlier is because he's gone to war with the left in the Labour Party, which he didn't have to do, he's now provoked a reaction.
Well, I mean, it's great for the Tories that he's done that.
Well, I know, and the problem is that he could have avoided that by just not picking a fight with the left. But his advisers, like Mandelson, are telling him if you pick fights with the left and you're seen to be fighting with them, that will look good to potential
switch voters.
Well,
someone actually did call out in Starmer's speech, where's Peter Mandelson or something?
Yes, indeed. So in other words...
What they're suggesting there is that Mandelson is the guy who should be up the front.
The strategists...
He's actually the secret leader of the party.
The strategists at the heart of the right wing of the party think that it is good politics to be seen to being having a war with the left. The problem is this: A, I don't think that's true, because in actual fact it just makes you look as if you're divided, and B, the left isn't going to go away, so you're going to end up antagonizing them, but you're not necessarily going to endear anybody else
anyway
to.
One of the things I thought would be interesting to do is to dip into the fringe down in Brighton. I think it was in Brighton, wasn't it, this time, Martin?
Yeah.
And the one of the fringe meetings was about the purged Labour, particularly about Jewish people who've been purged from the Labour Party in this what they call witch hunt by Keir Starmer and the new right-wing Labour Party, trying to emulate the successes of Blair, but not doing so well. Anyway, so I thought it'd be interesting to have a chat with someone who was at one of those conferences, fringe meetings, because he had a bit of an altercation with someone from LBC, the London independent, so-called independent, well, commercial radio station that does a lot of talk radio in London. I used to listen to them years ago when I lived in London, and they were actually quite good, but nowadays they seem to just sort of toe the usual City of London line and most things. But anyway, he's Tony Greenstein, and he is one of the first people, if not the first, I'm sure he'll tell us, Jewish members of the Labour Party to be expelled for anti-Semitism. And they were at this meeting discussing all this when this LBC guy turned up, and he talks about that right at the very end. But I was much more interested to hear what he makes of Starmer and the modern Labour Party, as he's obviously he actually lives in near Brighton somewhere, so it was very easy for him to pop down there and attend some of these fringe meetings, which he most definitely did. So let's have a listen to Tony now.
Oh, my name is Tony Greenstein. I was the first Jewish person to be expelled under the fake anti-Semitism allegations and campaign. My dad's a rabbi, and I'm an anti-Zionist, and a socialist, of course, so that's about it.
Can you take us through what happened, how you managed to get expelled?
Oh, well, I was targeted very, very early on by the Jewish labour movement and the Zionists. They obviously went for me, and I was suspended. I got a letter out of the blue in March 2016 saying you're being suspended for comments you're alleged to have made. They didn't tell me what the comments were until I had an investigation meeting. But 2 weeks later, the Telegraph and the Times ran with the story. So the bastards had leaked it to the national press, but hadn't told me. It was things like, you know, saying Israel had the same marriage laws as Nazi Germany. They thought that was anti-Semitic, so I just pointed out that I was quoting Hannah Arendt, who's the greatest political philosopher of the last century, a Jewish refugee from Nazi Germany as well.
With the Labour Party conference just about coming to an end now, what do you make of the whole transition that's been between the Corbyn and the Starmer era?
Well, I don't know whether it's a transition. I mean, it's the revenge of the right, isn't it? I mean, there is a determination on the part of the Labour right never ever to have an experiment with a left leader again. So they've changed the rules. So you have to get 20% of MPs to nominate candidates. I mean, they're basically tearing up everything. I mean, Starmer is a complete fraud. He was elected on the Corbynite programme and has ditched everything. I mean, have a look at his 10 pledges. I mean, they're still up on the web. I don't know how long they'll be there, but nothing he talked about, you know, democratic rights, civil liberties, migrant rights, all of it. Not a mention in his speech, of course. I mean, it's a hard right return to Blair. I mean, that's the reality of it.
So were you actually at the Labour Party conference then?
Oh, no, I wasn't admitted to the conference. No. I was on the fringe, of course. No, I wasn't at the conference itself.
Okay, so can you just take us... I know you had a bit of an altercation with a journalist there. Can you just take us through the reasons for it and what the fringe meeting was?
Yes, it was a Jewish Voice for Labour, and I'd been asked to attend, basically, to spot Zionists trying to get in, like David Collier and others, who would cause trouble or whatever, because we didn't really want the enemy in.
Hang on, Tony. Sorry, but I mean, surely these are open meetings, open to the public.
They are, but you still reserve the right to refuse admission to people who you don't want in. The Zionists don't exactly allow us into their meetings, even if they're public. So, I mean, there's no reason to allow racists into an anti-racist meeting, for example. And that's basically what it is. So, yes, it's a public meeting, but it's for the public, not for people who've a track record of trying to disrupt meetings.
What was this altercation about with the? First of all, what was the actual title of the fringe meeting, and who was speaking?
Well, Leah Levine was speaking. I mean, there were a number of speakers. I can't remember them all, to be quite honest, but they were Jewish. Andrea Gilbert from Labour, Black Socialist, was speaking. So, I mean, there's a fair number of speakers, but it was organised by Jewish Voices for Labour, or Jewish Voice for Labour, which is, if you like, the wrong sort of Jews, as far as the Zionists and Starmer are concerned.
Okay, so what was the topic of the meeting? What was the discussions there about?
Oh, well, the discussion was about what's been happening of late, the fact that if you're Jewish, you're five times more likely to get suspended or expelled. If you're a member of JVL, that goes up to 20 times, and if you're a member of their national committee, it's something like 250 times, so... There's a massive purge and witch hunt on. So attendance was down because a lot of people didn't attend because they didn't basically want to be fingered by people who were looking out for who attends what meetings, because simply attending a meeting is in itself grounds for expulsion now. So, I mean, that was really what the atmosphere and the content of the discussion was about.
Yeah, sounds quite poisonous. But isn't the Labour Party now in the process of implementing new rules that mean that just simply by either joining a proscribed group or whatever, you automatically become expelled from the party?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I mean, if they've prescribed four groups, three of which are in the Labour Party, and the two that I'm involved in, the Labour Against the Witch Hunt and the Labour in Exile Network. And if you've ever had any contact going back years with those groups, even just attending a public meeting on Zoom, then you will be expelled. They've backdated it. You know, usually legislation isn't retrospective, so it's an offence going forward, but not backwards. But the way they've interpreted it is if you've ever had any contact of whatever nature, even if you're just a supporter or they deem you to be a supporter, because they ask you to prove a negative, that you're not a supporter. That's what these investigation letters are containing. So it's just a ruse. They want the left out of the party, of course.
Well, it's not just the left, is it? Because it's just even people from the right who are curious to see what the left are saying, attending a meeting.
I haven't heard of that. I haven't heard of any right-wingers being expelled. I mean, it's all under the ruse of the false anti-Semitism. You know, you mention anything about Israel and you're out. You call it an apartheid state. That's grounds, in essence, for expulsion, although the Labour Conference itself has now passed policy saying Israel is an apartheid state. So I'm not sure whether they'll expel the whole conference or not. But, I mean, any form of dissent in the Labour Party today is grounds for expulsion. Greg Hadfield has just been expelled. He organised a Resist at Rialto fringe meeting with people like Peter Oborne, Ken Loach, and others there. He was given an expulsion notice overnight. He was greeted at the conference doors, literally, and told he couldn't come in. So, I mean, that's the atmosphere now. It's the McCarthyism. So, I mean, that's the context to what happened at the meeting.
Okay, so I mean, what do you actually put this down to? What's really behind all this?
Oh, it's fairly simple, isn't it? I mean, what was behind the false allegations and anti-Semitism campaign that was nothing to do with anti-Semitism was simply when Corbyn, who was an anti-imperialist, he'd supported the Palestinians, he'd opposed the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, etc. When he was elected, it was a great shock. It was a historical accident. And the Americans and the Israelis and, of course, the British establishment, the idea of someone in America's closest ally leading the second major party and possibly the party of government being opposed to the whole special relationship, NATO and so on, was unacceptable. So that's where the anti-Semitism campaign came from, because it wasn't about anti-Semitism, because all the worst racists in the party, like Tom Watson, John Mann, who wrote a book saying how to spot a gypsy and how they're a social problem. All of them jumped on the anti-Semitism bandwagon, Daily Mail included. You know, I mean, it wasn't about anti-Semitism, and what it was about keeping Labour safe for capitalism.
It does seem as if the legacy of the Holocaust has been kind of exaggerated. How do you feel about that as a Jew yourself?
Yeah, they've weaponized the Holocaust. I mean, they don't draw the conclusions from the Holocaust that refugees should be allowed into Britain. I mean, Israel, which uses the Holocaust more than anyone to deflect criticism, is busy trying to expel 40,000 black African refugees. And when its Holocaust propaganda museum, Yad Vashem, was approached to come out against the deportation of refugees, it absolutely refused. So the lessons the Zionists draw from the Holocaust are not that you can't, they're not anti-racist ones. They're ones which actually say that Israel must be stronger so it can commit ethnic cleansing. So the lessons they've learned are that if the Nazis did it, then the Zionists can do it too. Because the Nazis started off with expulsion of Jews as their aim, not extermination. The Holocaust was in the latter part of the Nazi regime. So, yes, I mean, the Holocaust has been weaponized. So we have all these Holocaust museums, the Holocaust Memorial Days and so on. And it's not really about the Holocaust. It's about defending Israel and providing it with a carte blanche. So in Germany, I mean, you know, this Bundestag passed unanimously a resolution opposing BDS, boycott, divestment and sanctions, and saying it was anti-Semitic. Unanimous between the neo-Nazi alternative for Germany and the left, the social democrats and even Die Linke. So, I mean, this is the absurdity we have. Germany expiates its guilt over the Holocaust by supporting Israel and what it does to the Palestinians.
Amazing. I mean, Shulamit Aloni, the former education minister in Israel, as well as actually the former Mossad Katzer, Viktor Ostrovsky, both talk about saying things like, it's a trick. We use this as a trick just to stop criticism. Do you think that's true?
Absolutely, yes, of course. I mean, how do you defend arresting children at 2 or 3 in the morning, blindfolding them, beating them, not allowing them to see their parents indefinitely, charging them in the language they don't understand, the sexual torture of, I mean, women in particular, young girls, is rife. How do you defend all that? Or just shooting people, shooting tear gas at schools, for example, which is a regular pastime in the Israeli army. You can't. So you accuse you accuse people of anti-Semitism. It's easy. It's the only thing you can do. You attack the person, not the argument.
Yeah, yes. What about this incident at this fringe meeting? Can you just take us through what happened with this LBC journalist?
Yeah, I mean, he came in. I was fairly suspicious of him, Theo Usherwood. He came in. He made a beeline right behind John McDonnell, who was also at the meeting. And it was clear to me what he was up to, because he started recording using his phone. So I approached him and told him he couldn't record. If he wanted to attend the meeting, that was fine. But he wasn't there to obtain information on who was attending. And when he refused to stop recording, I took the phone from his hand and threw it to the door, and he chased after it, and then he was evicted, although unfortunately he was let back. But some people are more soft-hearted than me. But yeah, he's a rabid right-winger. I mean, he's accused me online, on the LBC, of virulent anti-Semitism. He's fully behind the witch hunt. I mean, he's a nasty right-winger.
I mean, he's obviously put his point of view on LBC. Has he given you a chance of a right for reply?
No, I don't think so. No, I haven't been asked if I want to respond. They've just used it as a propaganda platform. But what he said is libelous, and I am going to sue them if they don't retract.
What about the future for the party, though, Tony? Do you think there's going to be much now? You know, we've seen this 2021 Labour conference. Is there really any future for it electorally?
I don't think so. I mean, Starmer has been an utter disaster, hasn't he? I mean, he's lost one by-election, which opposition parties usually don't do against the government. He nearly lost another one. And in the third by-election, Labour got something like 600 votes. The worst ever result at a by-election ever. Leave aside the local election results. Starmer is a disaster because he stands for nothing, so he appeals to no one, apart from his own wooden robotic style, which he's patented his own. But the guy is the deep state. He's a walking representative of that state. He was DP, Director of Public Prosecution. He sent Assange down, in essence. I mean, he's got an appalling record. He covered up, covered for the police when they murdered Ian Tomlinson. You remember the newspaper vendor, Charles Menendez? I mean, he also covered for Jimmy Savile, for that matter. I mean, the man's a total law and order robot. I mean, he's got nothing to say. There's nothing radical in him. And he's incredibly dishonest. He stood on a Corbyn platform. He hid the rich donors, people like Trevor Chin, a Zionist millionaire who gave him £50,000. He hid those donations until after the election had closed. So, no, I don't think Labour has got a great deal of chance, and it's sinking in the polls. basically.
Well, there's something called the Resistance Conference coming up in Nottingham. I think it's 16th and 17th of October, yes, where indeed. Quite a few people are getting together. I don't know if you're going to be participating, but what do you make of that?
I'm a speaker there, yes. Well, I've been invited to speak at it, and yes, it's a very good idea. The more the left get together and people who are fighting and campaigning get together to provide an alternative, that's good. I mean, yes, I support it wholeheartedly.
Okay, so where can listeners catch your stuff, your blog, etc., Tony?
www.azvsas.blogspot.com or tonygreenstein.com. That's where you'll find my blog. Okay?
Okay, you better spell the Greenstein.
Green, S, Sugar, Tango, Echo, India, November.com. TonyGreenstein.com. And you will get my words of wisdom.
Tony, thanks very much for joining us.
That's okay. Cheers then. Bye.
So that's Tony Greenstein, Martin. What do you make of what he had to say there? I mean, it's all sorts, I think, fascinating insight into what's been going on in the Labour Party, where it's where the left is heading in Britain. Tony's, I think, done a quite amazing job in summing up some of the, you know, the problems. And also, you know, there's also the sort of the Ian Tomlinson, a policeman that Starmer has covered up the murder of, or as DPP, refused to prosecute the police for that. He just talks about him as a politician that's got nothing to say.
Well, I mean, I don't disagree with a lot of what he said there. Starmer's people will say that they... What will probably happen is that Starmer won't win the next election. I think that's delusionary. One of the things that didn't happen at the conference is that was actually a majority of constituency parties had put forward motion to campaign for proportional representation. Starmer could have picked that up and ran with it. He didn't take, you know, he ignored it completely. And I think ultimately he's going to lose the next election. The Labour Party may split, in which case you'll have two potential left-wing candidates in each constituency, which will mean the Tories will run Britain forever. And of course, that's why Scotland will leave and Northern Ireland will probably, you know, ultimately become a united island, and then the Welsh will be put on the spot.
So let's just, I think, you know, look at some of the other stories to do with the conference. That is, I mean, the one of the big things that Starmer kicked off, we heard when he just spoke, was about the fuel crisis. What do you make of all of this?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's much doubt that the problem is that we haven't got enough people trained to drive HGV vehicles in the country. And, of course, a lot of...
Well, they see that there are all disputes about that, but anyway... You've got...
Yeah, well, you asked me what I thought, so I'm telling you. And I think that even government ministers have had to accept that their policy of hard Brexit with no freedom of movement of labour has definitely contributed to the crisis. That's certainly the perception out
well,
there on the forecourt.
Let's have a listen to Christian in County Durham speaking on Talk Radio this week.
My licence runs out in 5 days' time. I've sent all me bump off to the DVLA about 5-6 weeks ago now. Yeah. But we all got letters yesterday from the Department of Transport thanking us for all our hard work and everything.
Nice.
And and then anyone that's had a licence that isn't driving, you know, would they come back to the industry? Mm. But how can they find time to do, you know, all that sort of thing, but they can't sort the, you know, the licence out?
Yes, funnily enough, somebody I know also sent me a copy of that letter that they sent to everybody. So if they've got a database of people, they must also have a database of people who need their licences renewed, no?
You would think so, you know. They can. I mean, that took quite a bit of manpower and resources to sort of do all that.
Right.
You know, and you think, well, my licence runs out on the 5th of October. It says you may be able to drive if you get the advice.
But this is the thing, isn't it? It says, oh, you may be able to drive. So if you get stopped by the police and they say, where's your licence? Yeah. You say, well, the DVLA said I may be able to drive. And they go, well, actually, you can't drive, and here's a ticket.
Yeah, but I had a medical six sort of weeks ago.
Right.
The doctor filled out the form. I think it's a D4. So I've seen a doctor, and he's given me the form, and I've sent that to DVLA to say I'm fit to drive. So do I now have to see another doctor?
Why?
You know, it's a bit. What do you do? After the 5th of October, do I drive? Do I not drive? And
well, yeah. Help, you know, but also, why do you, if you've already passed the medical, why do you have to see another doctor for what?
Well, that's right. For what reason? And then pay another £90 for another medical.
Mm.
I just don't think it's helping the helping the job, is it? Because no one's quite sure what to do now, you know.
Anyway, so that was Christian in County Durham there. Martin explaining that many of these HGV drivers are just sitting there waiting for their licences to be returned from DVLA. He is one that's actually got a current licence, and it's running out on the 3rd of October. Middle of next week, he won't be able to drive anymore. And they've sent him a letter saying you may be able to drive. So they're saying, well, you know, even without a licence, we might say it's okay to drive. Now, he's just the tip of the iceberg. Obviously, there are thousands of other drivers who are also sitting around waiting for the DVLA. So now, for me personally, I had to renew my licence.
You haven't got an HGV licence, Tony, have you? You do drive a tank, but it's not an HGV.
It's nothing to do with this, Martin. And this is another one of your little straw men you're throwing in the mix there. I sent off my renewal license about 3 months ago to DVLA. I've heard absolutely nothing back. They say they're processing it. Nothing at all is returned. And so this is obviously one of the factors that we're not really hearing much about in the mainstream media, is that DVLA is basically on it's just not doing. Apparently, one of the things I've heard is that many of the staff of DVLA are still working from home, but obviously this causes all sorts of problems when you're trying to send documents backwards and forwards. DVLA basically is ground to a halt.
Well, I mean, what you're putting your finger on there is that there are still effects of the pandemic affecting things like the DVLA.
Is it really the pandemic? Well, why is the pandemic affecting DVLA?
Well, the DVLA was
It's just bad administration, isn't it? I mean, if this was run in-house in the government, there would be no excuses. But, of course, it's not. It's an agency which is outside. It's got a chief running it who's appointed by government, but it's not directly managed by the Department for Transport.
Well, all right. The fundamentals of this is that we are 100,000 HGV drivers short. And that's partly because the wages are rubbish. And there's lots of the average age of a HGV driver is 56.
So can the oil and 30,000 of those oil companies not afford to pay people?
No, let me finish, Tony.
Can they not afford to pinch a few drivers off of IKEA?
Well, the problem is that they're actually attracting bin lorry drivers into HGV work, because if wages rise for HGV drivers, and that's what John Redwood, for example, has suggested, let's say they were doubled. Yeah, from the 30 grand they are now to 60 grand. It would still be a time lag before you could train people up to drive trucks. And in actual fact,
I would say probably the more important factor is that there's a lot of hazardous chemical stuff to do with these things.
Indeed, in actual fact, driving things like petrol tankers, you don't just need an HGV license. Mm. The army apparently are being put on standby that they will come in and do it, but that all their drivers will have to be trained to handle petrol tankers.
So
which
what,
will take
how
some
come,
time. And
how come,
can I just finish? No, there's only 150 army
how
drivers.
Come, I'm asking
We've
you a
got 100,000.
How come? Two weeks ago we had enough drivers. Now we don't.
No, we didn't have enough drivers 2 weeks ago. But as the economy has come out of the lockdown, we've now crashed into the constraints.
Well, that happened about 6 months ago.
Well, Tony, the politics of this are pretty clear. On the forecourts, everybody is absolutely clear that we've lost 30,000 EU drivers that were in this country before the lockdown. They're not there now, and
so
they're
not coming back. Where were they 3 weeks ago, then?
They're all working in Europe where they've got visas to work.
Or else they haven't got a licence, maybe.
Well, no, Tony, the fact is you've got to accept as a pro-Brexit person that Brexit carries prices as well as sovereignty and all of the things that you want.
Of course I do, but I think this is confected by the oil companies.
No, it's not confected by the oil companies.
Oh, your oil companies, you think they're honest, do you? That oil cartel, they're a really honest bunch.
No, they're not, but you'd be nationalised, like in Norway.
Well, I agree with you.
Or like in Russia.
And then we would actually know what's going on. But they're not. They're all covered by commercial confidentiality. They can hire as many or as few people as they want.
In any case, the real problem is ultimately to do with the gas prices and all the rest of it. Now, ultimately, if wages were to rise to attract people into this industry, and don't forget, it's not the case, we've got a real shortage of care workers, yeah, nurses. This stuff in the petrol stations is hitting people in their faces, but there's lots of other stuff where we haven't got enough people to do the jobs. But this,
put the wages up.
Yeah, but yes, let's put the wages up, Tony, but if you put the wages up, then the prices in the shops have to go up as well, and therefore your economy shrinks. And all these are the anti-competitive pressures of making decisions about Brexit based on ideology, not on economics. And ultimately, the economics of Brexit were always going to be negative.
It's a practical thing. You've got to put the wages up if you want to employ people.
Yes, and if you put the wages up, you then become uncompetitive.
Are you telling me?
No.
Martin, listen a minute, right?
No.
Just listen a second, right? Are you telling me that the oil companies can't afford to put the wages of their tanker drivers up?
I'm telling you that they...
You are or not?
No.
Yes or no?
The reason they're not putting the wages up is because there is an element of competition, even though it's a cartel. Now, if they all put their wages up, and then that means petrol prices have to rise. Petrol price is one of the most fundamental prices in an economy, especially in modern economies as motorised as ours. That means that all the costs in all the other industries go up. That means prices go up. That means inflation goes up. That means you have to raise interest rates to put inflation down, which means your economy starts to go down. And that's what's happening. The Purchasing Managers Index for September has crashed completely. All businesses, the Institute of Directors were saying it yesterday, are facing a winter where they are basically going to be cutting production, and we're going to go into a major recession. Now, if Britain goes into a major recession while Europe comes out,
Maybe you'll finally get
your crash. Yeah, but there'll be a crash just in Britain, and everybody's going to know what caused it. It's your Brexit.
It's not my Brexit, is it?
You voted for it, Tony, and you've campaigned for it for many years.
You voted for Keir Starmer, and look what a disaster he's been.
Yeah, but that's a different question.
No, it isn't. It's the same question.
Keir Starmer is not the question. Brexit is a fundamental problem for the British economy, and it's going to be a fundamental problem going forward.
Sovereignty, and of course, the banksters, the international elite, don't want Brexit.
No, it's not
just
that.
And actually, they do want Starmer.
No, they don't necessarily want Starmer, they just want the Tories.
Yes, they do. No, he's perfect for the Tories, that's why they want him.
Well, in any case...
They love Starmer.
Yeah, but the point about this is what you've got to accept, Tony, is that there are costs to Brexit.
Well, of course I do, and so do you, so does everybody.
No, we were told...
I wish you would stop personalising this, right? I've just done the same to you, which is really pretty silly of me, but we're trying to talk about serious issues. The idea that Brexit happened because it's my Brexit is just infantile.
All right, let's just say those who wanted Brexit have to accept that there are going to be big costs associated with it.
Yeah, and also the other thing is that guess what side the oil cartels are on? Are they pro-Brexit?
They don't care about Brexit.
They don't care. Rubbish. They are, of course, they're pro-Brexit. These people are anti-Brexit. Anti-Brexit. They're all Bilderbergers, these people.
No, Tony.
They are.
No.
They are. Exxon and Shell. These people, you know.
Most business, small or large, was against Brexit.
Transnational corporations.
Most businesses.
Transnational corporations
didn't
want it.
Most businesses, the Federation of Small Businesses, the Institute of Directors, the CBI, they were all against Brexit.
That's not true.
Actually,
the Federation of Small Businesses was pro-Brexit.
No, it wasn't.
Yes,
Tony.
They were.
No.
Anyway, okay, so...
They weren't.
They were.
Just factually
small
wrong.
Businesses have suffered.
No, Small Business Federation was against it. The business leadership of this country and the trade unions were all against Brexit.
So you're a Mandelsonian businessman now,
No, I'm not.
We've got to do what the businesses say.
No, I'm not, Tony.
You are.
I'm just pointing out that you and the Tory party, who claim to be in favour of business... I've actually sabotaged British business,
Much of the Labour Party was pro-Brexit too, but it's just
that's
it got
right.
completely ignored and sidelined by people like you.
Yes, it didn't get completely ignored and sidelined by me. I'm a minor player, Tony. The costs of Brexit are now going to... As we go through this winter, it'll be very interesting to see, come next spring, what people's views on Brexit are.
Okay, what are your views on Greta Thunberg?
Well... She's a very nice girl.
Let's have a listen to her now, talking about blah, blah, blah.
There is no planet B. There is no planet blah. Blah, blah, blah. Blah, blah, blah. This is not about some expensive, politically correct green act of bunny hugging or blah, blah, blah. Build back better. Blah, blah, blah. Green economy. Blah, blah, blah. Net zero by 2050, blah, blah, blah. Net zero by 2050, blah, blah, blah. Net zero, blah, blah, blah. Climate neutral, blah, blah, blah.
Well, she goes on for about 5 minutes like that, and I won't pain you by making you listen to the whole thing. But nothing ever quite seems to be good enough for Greta. I mean, the government's changed its policy to net zero, and still not good enough. And she says, "Oh, well, they're not really serious about it; they're just blah blahing."
Well, that's what radicals who don't have to stand for elections are supposed to do. she was trying to get elected, she'd have to say something else. But she's not trying to get elected to anything. So her role is to just keep snapping away like a little terrier and trying to, you know, get what she wants done.
With zero carbon, are we going to be able to function as a nation, as a world, with no carbon?
Well, these are bigger issues. I mean, you know, we're talking about...
Well, Greta, what she wants, isn't
well,
it?
I mean, Greta Thunberg is 18 years old now. She's about to go to university. I read an interview with her the other week. And, you know, she's got her views. We all know them. You know,
is it going to be a success, this, what's it called, COP26? Because
no,
there are problems
that
the Chinese are thinking about not going, as are the French, because of other geopolitical disputes.
It was always going to be difficult to get all of these countries to agree to do anything about something as complex as this. So it was always an uphill struggle. And, of course, the British being the host for this, you know, they've gone out of their way to alienate various people like the Chinese and the French, and an easy way for the Chinese and the French to snub us is not to turn up for this, so they're not coming.
Okay. Also, what do you make this week of the collapse of South East Rail? It's the third of the franchisees to collapse. £25 million of public money they were stealing, defrauding.
Well, it doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, in actual fact, all of these utilities should be in public ownership. And coming back to the Labour conference, the Green New Deal, and supported by Ed Miliband, is that we should renationalise the energy industry. But Starmer has ruled that out, even though conference have voted in favour of it. And, of course, conference doesn't decide anything. But in actual fact, we should never have privatised the railways or the energy industry or anything else that was privatised during the Thatcher era. But we've never gotten back and done it properly and gotten them back into public ownership.
I mean, in a weird way, it was almost like a massive con that went on, wasn't it, between the Second World War and the 1980s when these things were privatised. They were brought into public, they were taken off of the people that had built them up, the families and the
Some of the industries were created by the state.
Shareholders. Well, they were. I mean, for example, the railways, you know. And those people that had created those industries and run them very well, what happened was that infrastructure was then taken off of those people, requisitioned by the government. And a few years later, a generation later, they said, oh, well, we made a mistake there. And it was just flogged off internationally, actually, to the highest bidder, the richest people in the world.
Well, when they were nationalised in the first place, they'd been running at a loss for many years. So in actual fact, the people being paid compensation, perhaps they should have been nationalised without compensation, but they weren't.
I'm sorry, but the private business that runs at a loss has just got to be shut down.
No, if it's a railway industry or the gas industry or even, you know, there's some things that are fundamental to the functioning of your economy.
That's the case during the war, right? But surely they would have picked up after the war.
Well, they could have carried on running them in the private sector after the war, but that's not what happened. Because in actual fact, people had realised that during the war, the economy had been better managed than it had been before the war. And that in actual fact, having a plan of knowing what you wanted to do was often quite much better than the idea of just relying on private enterprise to cook up some kind of cock and bull strategy.
But actually, much of this infrastructure was built by private enterprise,
things like the gas
ideas.
Industry and the water industry were actually built by the municipal authorities. The Birmingham local authority created the gas industry and the water industry.
But not the railways, for example.
But anyway. The railways had been built up by private enterprise, but in Switzerland, for example, they have a nationalised railway far more efficient than ours.
This isn't Switzerland, is it?
No, it's not. Kerry, there's no reason why that definitely
another,
isn't Switzerland.
Another issue we're going to try and cover, as we've got to zoom through stuff tonight, is the protests on the M25 by... this Insulate Britain group, which of course is not really Insulate Britain at all, it's just XR trying to save its face. So I spoke to an old colleague of mine from the Newbury Bypass Road protests when I was living back in Oxford years ago, Kerry Fielding. It just turns out that he has done an MSc. He's just literally today or yesterday got confirmation that he's got a distinction in his MSc at the Centre for Alternative Technology looking at insulation. And much of what he's saying makes a tremendous amount of sense, and none of which, of course, is being talked about by Insulate Britain because they don't really care or know anything about insulation. It's just an excuse to not call themselves XR. So I started by asking Kerry about the, you know, sort of referring back to this whole idea of, you know, the protests that we were involved in against the Newbury bypass many years ago and the general road protests in that era in the 1990s. What makes a successful protest? And as we both agree, this certainly doesn't.
As you know, Tony, as we'd be classed as veterans of the road protests by the media. So, yeah, long experience of environmental campaigning, direct action, and in fact, even kind of, you know, blockading Shell petrol stations over issues in the Niger Delta.
Well, that's right. I can remember actually standing shoulder to shoulder with you in Oxford, blockading a Shell petrol station after the murder execution of Ken Sarawira, who was a playwright over in Nigeria, who was murdered by employees, basically mercenaries employed by Shell petrol, who, because he was leading a very popular campaign in Nigeria against Shell. So ironic that in the week that we've got these queues outside petrol stations, that we were there actually blockading Shell. And we, you know, people could, of course, they could go down the road and get petrol from somebody else, BP, Texaco or something in those days. But this is, you know, it's an issue that some people feel quite strongly about, isn't it?
The lesson I took from those actions, Tony, particularly blockading the petrol station, you remember how tempers flared very quickly. And, you know, it was a matter of trying to actually sort of de-escalate situations. But people were very angry. And so the lesson I took from that direct action is really, first of all, try not to alienate your public. You want to win hearts and minds. You want to win the public over to your way of thinking. You don't want to make them angry. You don't want to make them late, and all of that. Now, I mean, this insulate Britain. I mean, couldn't make it up. Right, really, stranger than fiction. I have just submitted my dissertation on how to sustainably insulate the United Kingdom and our old leaky housing stock. And then all of a sudden there's a new direct action group blocking the M25, causing huge delays, really, you know, disrupting people's lives at a time when they are already seriously disrupted. And I've checked their website, I've read their report, and it's very short. They're very short on details. So that's the other lesson I took from direct action. One is don't alienate your potential allies. And the second, not just an explanation, but preferably a viable alternative. If we're going to protest against something, we need to have alternatives to propose, viable, sustainable alternatives. So those are the two key important things, neither of which Insulate Britain have. However, that said, I don't want to diss them totally. They have raised a very important subject. It's just that they're quite misinformed and misguided. But what they have done is created the opportunity, opened the conversation that can potentially sort of open up the facts for people.
Well, I think Kerry's done a pretty good job there in just explaining what the problem is with these kinds of protests, Martin. You're alienating the people that you're trying to bring on board, which doesn't make any sense. It's totally irrational. And the other thing is they don't have actually some sort of alternative. They've got a kind of platform and a programme.
Well, I suppose from their point of view, not that I know much about them, the idea of focusing on insulation means that the Extinction Rebellion are just, you know, saying we've got to change everything, but they're not saying exactly what. Insulation, at least, is a concrete proposal.
Well, it's not a proposal, it's happening, because there are insulation programs, in fact, free insulation programs for people with not enough money right across the country, which will come into your house and insulate it if you haven't got the money to do it yourself.
Yeah, but we're way behind other countries on stuff like that. And, of course, the actual building regulations in this country, which are written by the planning, by the developers.
As as he points out, actually much of the housing stock is hundreds of years old. Well, so, you know, you can't legislate for that. And no. So this is where, what people can do. If they want insulation in their homes, there are government programs that will do it for nothing.
Well, that's true, but there are, in other countries, they're far ahead of us on this. I mean, especially in Scandinavian countries where it gets very cold in the winter, they're very hot on insulation.
Anyway, you know, I'll put this full interview with Kerry Fielding up on our show page because it's fascinating. He really gives us a snap insight into what was in his dissertation, which is all about the different types of insulation. And if you're going to start insulating, what kind of insulation you should use. And he makes the point, which Greta Thunberg would probably make if she knew anything about it, that almost all the insulation today is plastic insulation. So let's have a listen now to another clip from him. Why he's saying, why is it that plastic insulation is not what's the best thing to use? Plastic is obviously the sort of thing that was used on Grenfell.
The problem is that we're doing it all with plastic, Tony. And plastic is the highest embodied energy insulation material.
Okay, so that effectively means that it's taken more energy than other products to actually produce the stuff in the first place.
Precisely. Okay, so a little bit about plastics, okay? If global plastic production was a country, it would be the fifth biggest emitter in the world. Okay, it's a huge global industry. Now, construction uses 25% of global plastic production. So it's very big. So we need to reduce the use of plastics in construction, simply to reduce embodied energy. For example, wood fibre insulation produced in Europe takes a tenth of the amount of energy to produce as plastics. Even mineral wool insulation, the only non-combustible insulation which is produced in Britain, involves quarrying basalt, melting it in a furnace and spinning it in a centrifuge. Even that uses about half the amount of energy to produce as plastic insulation. Now, so plastic insulation is massive global. The ingredients for it come from all over the world. They're dependent on non-renewable oil-based resources, so they're going to become rarer and more expensive anyway. And we just need to cut them out of the equation, basically. Would you like me to expand more?
Yes, please, yeah.
So, okay, so how do we reduce plastics, use of plastics? Well, first of all, we've got a big problem. Plastics in Britain are big business. Okay. We produce 3.3 million tons a year of plastic materials in the UK, which is the third largest manufacturing sector. Okay, so plastic manufacturing is the third largest manufacturing sector in the UK. Produced in 2015, I think it was. Yeah, in 2015, we exported £7.5 billion worth of raw materials for plastic production elsewhere. Okay, those are HazChem. They're basically sort of hazardous chemical registered with special transport requirements, highly toxic chemicals. Isocyanate, cyanates, MDIs. These things have been associated with, in fact, even Bhopal in India in the 80s was related to polyurethane production. So it's a really nasty, toxic industry, big business in this country, lots of vested interests. Of which plastic insulation is obviously just a part. Incidentally, our exports in 2015 were 7.5 billion. That was, but our imports were 11.6 billion.
Okay, so plastic insulation, plastic itself, Martin, is a massive industry. He's saying that, look, it may be cheaper, all this insulation that the Insulate Britain want to use, But it's mega toxic, and they should be not using this stuff at all.
Well, I don't know what Insulate Britain have said. I mean, he's obviously looked into it, and I haven't.
They haven't said anything about different types of insulation. Indeed. If they want Britain to insulate, unless they have got some sort of... they haven't even... It doesn't seem to me that they've actually done any homework at all on what it would mean to insulate Britain. They've just picked up this name and this word, and they're bandying it around. But anyway, I also talked to Kerry, and the final clip we're going to hear from him, and that, like I say, there's the full interview will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, where he talks in detail about all these different things he's been looking into as part of his dissertation, the different types of plastic, how much to do it, how to actually get the various industries to change to using much better forms of insulation, non-plastic stuff around the country, what we need to do to change the way we're doing things, particularly through this COP, what's it called?
26.
COP 26. But also the problems that we may not have the Chinese coming. And also, of course, the Chinese are still producing something like 50% or more of their industries are using coal. So what is the point of us, punishing ourselves whilst China is still churning this stuff out and doing very well, thank you very much, on the international financial markets? We're just doing something which is supposedly good for the planet. Well, it is good for the planet. But what's the point until the Chinese get on board?
The point is that they've achieved in five decades, if you like, in 50 years, they have achieved the industrial growth that took us a couple of centuries. And we are one of the biggest historic emitters. So our nations have produced a lot of CO2 historically. So we've made a very considerable historic contribution. We're in decline now. China has come up very quickly. It's going to peak very quickly. And they will also, I predict, reduce their emissions very quickly.
Yeah. So is there anything else you want to add?
Yeah, I want to add that we can do it. What Insulate Britain or XR or whoever they are, it doesn't really matter, or how badly informed they are, and it's what it does matter is that the government doesn't actually turn around and start insulating houses in the same way we've been doing it. We need transformative change. We need to educate people. People need to understand the scale on which we need to do this. It will create a massive, massive new growth industry, green growth industry in this country, producing natural fibre insulation, which will involve also retraining a lot of the building skills and wet trades specifically towards use of lime instead of cement. We need to understand how our buildings work. 32% of Welsh housing was built pre-1919, so over a century old. The way in which these buildings function is not reflected in any of the modelling for energy performance certificates or any of it. So we need a complete overhaul of everything. People need to understand, to know when the house was built, of what materials, how it works. And then we need appropriate fabric compatible, breathable materials for them. Only natural fibers have those properties. So we potentially, what we need to do is increase our forest areas. We need to increase our usable softwood timber production as well. It's all about resilience, sourcing. The best way to get low embodied building materials is for them to be locally or naturally sourced. Resilience, self-sufficiency, all of these things are factors that the population of the UK, like it or not, we're going to be forced by circumstance to find the solution.
Kerry Fielding, who's just finished his MSc at the Centre for Alternative Technology in Macunclith in West Wales. Absolutely beautiful piece of work. He's picked on such an important and interesting topic, which is insulation. I mean, if you're going to start stuffing this plastic in, Martin, rather than thinking about what you're doing, you're insulating, but then you're just cooking up even more problems for the future. The toxicity of the plastic to begin with, the manufacturing process, the fact that it's sitting around in your house. But also, one of the things he points out in the longer interview is that the plastic is not breathable. It actually doesn't allow air through, and so you get fungus, damp and mould if you use plastic, whereas you don't with these other materials.
Well, that's right, and of course, the transformations required aren't just tinkering. And of course, what I would also add is you've got to do things like complete reform of the financial system, dismantling of the military-industrial complex.
Well, there's a massive lobby out there, the plastic industry, that's going to try and stop this, isn't
there? Indeed. What will happen is even if we start taking steps...
Let's set Greta on them.
Yeah, well, even if we start taking steps in the right direction, I mean, nobody now claims that they're not green. Nobody. That includes, you know, the
City of London.
The City of London. it includes the far right. Even they care for small, cuddly animals and so on. The question is, what is really required here? And of course, what it really required is a complete change of system. And we're a long way from
that. You're going to get your revolution, do you think? Are you ever going to get it?
Well, it depends what you mean by revolution, doesn't it, Tony? We could get a social breakdown with a lot of people killed. So that might be called a revolution. Because of the bloodshed, but the word revolution is you know much abused. It's like the word fascist. Well, what does it mean?
Well, I would say a real revolution. I mean, they very often they're hijacked. In fact, 9 times out of 10, the people who are being revolutioned against are quite ready and prepared with their new system and infiltrate the revolutionaries so that they get there to control the outcome. Order ab chao, some people call it, order from chaos, which is the motto of the Scottish Rite of Freemasons and Albert Pike and his crew. But there's also this whole idea of turning the world upside down, isn't there, Martin?
Well, the word revolution originally meant, in the Middle Ages and going back into the classical era, just a change of leadership. And the idea was that revolutions happen fairly automatically.
What about Marx? What did he mean?
Dynasties fell and other people took over. Well, Marx took his concept of revolution from the French Revolution.
Oh, nasty.
Yeah, but the idea is that as Mao Zedong, of course, took it from the same stable. Mao Zedong said that revolution is an act of violence by which one class overthrows another.
Well, okay, the French Revolution, some would point out, including Dennis Wheatley, what does he know, that this was the revenge of the Knights Templars on the French monarchy.
Well, there are all sorts of things going on in the French Revolution, and the more...
Not a single person who was descended from Philip the Fair survived the French Revolution, apparently.
Well, that may be so, Tony, but in actual fact, most modern historians don't look at it in those terms,
as you
can imagine.
No, most modern historians don't look at 9/11 in the terms we do,
either. No, but I mean, you can't just bundle 9/11 in with the theory of revolution from the 19th century.
No, I'm not. I wasn't doing that. I was contrasting. You know, we've got massive areas of academia who I would suggest are simply bought and paid for stables of influence.
What you've actually got is there's a huge historical argument about what the French Revolution was.
Anyway, we had a very British version of revolution, and that is, I think, this whole idea of the world turned upside down. In fact, you might not believe this, but I actually bought last weekend. I bought a world turned upside down tea towel. I couldn't quite believe it in the old Cromwell Museum because I was over there last week. We had a lot of fun, actually. Maybe I should do that. If any listeners have got ideas of where they want us to have this show live from on a Friday, because we've now just about perfected the idea. Well, I shouldn't say that. It's tempting fate of doing these live broadcasts. So if you've got an idea of where we should be live one Friday, do let me know. At least give me a few weeks' notice and I'll see what I can to do that and do the show from there, since we're able to do that now. Last weekend I was over at the Common Rights Holders, the Chakra, the Skulthead and District Common Right Holders Association's annual general meeting in North Norfolk. And whilst I was over there, I dropped in to see some people that I've only ever really chatted to on the phone before, Paul Crofts and Richard Jacks from the Independent Socialists in Wellingborough, who were actually fascinating and really into their history, as I am. And the reason for Wellingborough, Martin, is that this is where one of the places where the diggers were in the English Civil War.
Well, that may be so, but what do they have to say?
The diggers in the English Civil War?
Well, no, these guys...
Well, we'll be hearing from them in a minute, but what's the significance of these diggers to you as a socialist?
Well, we had the discussion about this when you went up to Wigan to the diggers. The diggers have been more influential in modern times on the left wing in Britain. In the previous eras, the levellers were more influential because they were more mainstream.
Yeah, there were more of them, that's right.
Yeah,
they were soldiers.
And that's right. And, of course, ultimately, if you talk about the world turned upside down, the English Revolution, if you like, failed for the majority of the people. So, in actual fact,
it wasn't a revolution, was it? It was a civil war. That's why it's called the Civil War.
Well, I mean, yes.
There were some people like John Rees who likes to think about it as the level of revolution. He's the guy from the so-called Stop the War group in London who refused to be interviewed about his book because he knew I was going to ask him some awkward questions about his book. I think it's called The Level of Revolution. And, of course, it wasn't a revolution at all.
Well, it was an attempted revolution.
And it was hijacked right from the start. But anyway, let's have a listen now to the Indie Socialists in Wellingborough, that is Paul Crofts and Richard Jacks, because I went out with them in the evening, last Saturday evening, when we were over there. I think it was Saturday. And they took me to the memorial, which had been actually constructed to the Wellingborough diggers from the English Civil War, and they explained why, who the diggers were, and why they're still relevant today.
My name's Paul Crofts, and I'm a member of Independent Socialists in Wellingborough, a small socialist group which continues to keep the flames of socialism alive. And we're here in Prologis Park, which is a new distribution warehouse centre.
If you say new, how long has it been here?
This has been here about 5 years, Richard.
Five years
or so this was built. So it's pretty new. And that link line is very new. That wasn't here the last time I was here. So this is an area that's growing as a distribution area with warehouses. And in the heart of it is a small plaque to the Wellingborough diggers. And most people are unaware of the Wellingborough diggers, but this area of land in the 17th century was, of course, all farmland. It wasn't farmland, it was common land.
Well, I'd say probably even 10 years ago it might have been farmland, mightn't it?
Well, it's still farmland, yeah, until 10 years ago it was farmland. But in 1649, when the diggers were around, it was common land. It belonged to the people and was used by everybody for their cattle, to grow crops, and it didn't belong to anybody. It was subsequently enclosed and became owned by somebody, but prior to that, it was common land. And in 1649 there was terrible famine in Wellingborough. The people were starving, and things were very, very bad. And a group of local residents who were inspired by the writings of Gerard Winstanley decided to occupy the common land and to sow seed and to try and grow crops to feed their families. And they issued a declaration, which is the original is now in the British Museum, but we have facsimiles which are available, which
There's a copyright here in the business park, actually, which is rather nice, isn't it? It's all printed as if it was just straight out of the English Civil War, actually. The same typefaces, even at the bottom of it, it says London, printed for Giles Calvert, 1649.
Yes, and that's a facsimile of the original Wellingborough Digger Declaration, which is in the British Museum. And Prologis, the company that developed the distribution centre, agreed that there should be a plaque to the Wellingborough diggers following being suggested to them by local people who wanted some memorial to the Wellingborough diggers.
Now, you've got your colleague here as well. Could you just introduce yourself briefly and say, who were the diggers? Why did they decide to do that at that time? Because this is straight after the Civil War, which must have been quite traumatic.
I think I'm Richard Jackson. I'm also a member of the ISW. I think it was a traumatic period in the history, and I think the movements were very embryonic, and I think in this part of the country they were divided too, and there were different things going in different parts, and it was coinciding with the Civil War. And there was a desire to try and establish something independent. And in a curious way, there was a lot of free thinking. And Gerald Winstanley's inspiration sort of carried forth into the neighbourhood. It's a shame, actually, that this hasn't carried forward to this day. But there were people, and there were movements, and there were movements of autonomous groupings.
Now, it's actually got a pretty good timeline here as well. Luke, taking us right from 1609, well before the Civil War even started.
That's right, absolutely. And it takes us all the way along, right the way through to our own kind of more recent 2011, the first Diggers Festival we had locally, which was inspired by a succession of different left-wing people coming together in Wellingborough. And we've held this event probably for the last six or 7 years. It got a little bit quiet last year. It involved music, poetry, involved lectures at the local Quaker House, and people making speeches. And we had Alan Moore, who's a famous author based in Northampton, giving an incredible speech about the importance of the radical history of Northamptonshire in 2016, I think it was, who wrote a history of Northamptonshire called Jerusalem, which is really interesting. He gave a lovely talk about the importance of the radical movements of the county. A lot of this is fed into the more kind of recent activities which Paul and others have led in defiance of the council cuts that have happened in the division of this county into two bits as well.
I'm wondering, why is this still, if it is, still relevant today? Because we've got... this amazing business park, nothing like what this all, I mean, this is, seems to be thriving, but it's not, you don't see people here, it's just trucks. In fact, you hardly get anyone to speak to, would you?
No, you have very few people to speak to. I think basically this place is a sort of is almost a metaphor for basically what we've come to in this country half the time, that the county, which is prided on being next to the Rhondda Valley, the most intensively run industry part of the country, which is boots and shoes, is reduced to being basically something to do with its location, which is warehousing and nothing else. No skills, poor people who are completely divided in terms of any union recognition.
There's a tremendous amount of history, even in the town centre in Wellingborough.
There is a huge amount of history in the town centre, and I think there is this massive absence of a sense of local affinity. You know, there is an association sometimes between the idea of civic pride being a right-wing thing. Well, it isn't necessarily, because I think people should feel an affinity to their towns. And I showed you slightly earlier two kind of redundant buildings, which are probably the best examples of Tudor architecture anywhere, which by right should be taken over and used for public benefit.
Amazing. What's your thoughts on the relevance of what we see in front of us here today?
Well, Winstanley and writing in the 17th century was concerned about land ownership. He was concerned about the enclosure movement and the taking over of land by the aristocracy and the growing middle classes buying in land.
And just to explain, because the enclosure, what happened was people. These were private acts of Parliament, but let's not forget this is well before the Reform Act, so only people with large amounts of land could even vote in those days. So they were voting themselves private ownership of the land.
Absolutely. And the common people, up until that point, there was at least some common land which that belonged to the people. And once they were dispossessed of that, they had nothing except ultimately their labour power, which of course in subsequent centuries, the 18th and 19th century, formed the modern working class moving into towns and cities, because they were dispossessed from the land. But in the 17th century, people were still essentially tied to the land. But the diggers and the digger movement was inspired by Winstanley, who said that the land belongs to them. It wasn't given to the wealthy. The wealthy had stolen it from the common people, and in fact he went even further and said that these Normans who came in 1066 dispossessed the Saxons. He often talked to the digger movement and others often talked about the Norman yoke still being relevant to the oppression of the peasantry and the people of England and of course perhaps other
parts of the United Kingdom as well. But at that time, of course, it wasn't so much a United Kingdom.
Okay, so how do people follow what you guys are doing here in Wellingborough?
Well, I think there is obviously, there's not as much activity as there used to be. But if they wanted to find out, ISW puts itself out on Facebook pages. We often have demonstrations in, we often have activities in town around particularly core issues around, around deprivation, around in terms of Paul and I, it's international moves like Palestine Solidarity, but other things that which are to do with what's going on with cuts and fighting the cuts in town and getting involved, I think, in general left-wing activities, which is particularly pertinent to this town, as we've got probably Britain's worst MP at the moment, and called Peter Bone, who is absolutely atrocious. He's used to employ people on 89 pence an hour and this sort of thing, who's, you know, for his voting record, I'm supporting everything right-wing that moves. So
we understand that the Taliban have just appointed him as their representative in the United Kingdom because their policies are so closely aligned.
Okay, guys.
It is atrocious. So yes, I mean, there is a lot of work still to be done. It's a case of classic Lenin, two steps forward, right, one step forward, two steps back.
I'm asking you both an awkward question because socialism seems to be out the window with Keir Starmer taking over the Labour Party. The last hope, really, was surely Corbyn, and he's long gone.
Well, the you can't snuff out a flame that dates back well before even the 17th century. You had John Ball and the ideas of socialism, common ownership, people looking after each other, caring for each other, not being driven by profit, the profit motive, by private ownership, but by a morality and an ethics which says we should care and cooperate and work together. That can't be killed off by Keir Starmer. That will survive, and it will survive Jeremy Corbyn as it has done over the centuries. And you know, the words of Win Stanley are essentially socialist words from the, okay, they're couched in biblical language, but essentially the Bible, the quotes from the Bible are about humanity and about how humanity survives, and that will continue post, in fact it will definitely continue beyond Keir Starmer.
What are your thoughts about the death of socialism?
I think you're asking a person who's 64, and you just ask somebody who's even older than me. Quite frankly, ask young people, because they're our future, and that is the main problem we've got, is actually politicisation, or sometimes a depoliticisation of young people. And it's critical that an environmental agenda is embraced and understand with the context of what Jim Stanley was saying as well. Okay. And I think a lot of young people could be kind of brought into the whole equation. XR is a good example of where, you know, politics is becoming alternative, truly alternative, and less of the constraints around party politics and the ridiculous sort of polarities that exist.
Okay, well, from Wellingborough, from the Diggers Memorial, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And,
so, yeah, so that's Paul Crofts and Richard Jacks. From Wellingborough last weekend. Martin, it's fascinating looking at this, the long view of socialism. They're saying that actually these ideas will live forever, and actually Keir Starmer can't stop them.
Well, I broadly agree with that. And don't forget that you've still got the Chinese economy, which is based on, you know, they claim to be a socialist economy.
They're not Christians, though, are they?
No, they're not. No, they're not, Tony.
So what is going on with Marx?
Do you have to be a Christian to be a socialist?
What is going on with Marx? Is he basically taking, because, I mean, there is this famous quote, isn't there, in the Book of Acts about having all things in common, as the disciples did. Jesus and his followers had all things in common. But Marx seems to have decided that that's okay, but you're not allowed to talk about Jesus at all.
Well, you've got to distinguish between Marxist socialists and Christian socialists. I mean, Christian socialism has a long and honourable history.
Well, funny
but
enough,
some Marxists are. I mean, you know, the Latin American leadership, like people like Chavez and so on, were Christians, Catholic Christians, but also they were Marxists.
It seems to me, if you take the anti-Christian side of it out, Marx is much, much better. Also, you were talking about the Christian socialists. One of the most famous was Charles Kingsley, And it's funny because just down the road from Wellingborough is Ely, which is where one of the most famous books by Charles Kingsley was all about Hereward the Wake. And he discussed the, you know, the sort of what the Normans were imposing in the Norman invasion and how Hereward resisted the Norman invasion very successfully in Ely. And so, yeah, all that part of the country is fascinating. Also, amazing to hear radical Northamptonshire, the whole history of how Northamptonshire was played a major part, because, of course, that part of the world, I didn't realise until I drove around there, is a massive amount of agriculture going on, particularly in Norfolk, but even west of that too. But anyway, so ultimately with the diggers and the land, we have a kind of link up with what's going on today, because Bill Gates is doing everything he possibly can to buy up. In fact, he's promised to buy up most of the Western world's farmland, and he's doing it already. He's using his massive wealth to buy farmland up.
Well, the struggle for access to land as a key resource is a major issue in developing countries. And of course, one of the things that happened in China when the Communist Party took over is they redistributed the land. Mm. So millions of people got access to land who'd never had it before, and people who used to dominate it were frankly eliminated. It was a bloody revolution. Lots of people died.
And they redistributed the Christians too, although there were that many around. Anyway, thank you to Irish public and Labour activist Martin Summers there. And to our friends in Independent Socialists in Wellingborough. My book on the Fourth Reich, containing 30 years of research into the origins of the Bilderbergers, in the deals done between the Nazis and the Allies, and the links back to World War II Battle of Arnhem, portrayed in the film A Bridge Too Far, is out in paperback. You can get it from Amazon. Not from Amazon. Yes, you can, I think. Oh, gosh. Anyway, you can certainly get it from eBay quite easily if you're in the UK, and it can be sent abroad too. Price £15, including postage. That will just take you through the whole of the endgame of the Second World War, including all the nuclear stuff as well. And my anthology on secret government from Cromwell to the assassination of Princess Diana, called The Siege of Heaven Reader. You can get them on eBay and the Siege of Heaven ebook, and links to all of them via www.bilderberg.org. And there's been some problems with that site. Just see if you can use a different browser or click through. Some browsers are stopping people looking at that site. Anyway, join us in a minute as we take our weekly look at the real big investigations of the week, which is the crooked police in South Wales and the Metropolitan Police too. Thank you. Okay, so that's from 1972, the tour in Japan. It's, I quite like the bit where Ian Gillan there is singing, you're only about 4'6", but don't worry about it. Obviously, he says there's always someone smaller than you. So I'm not quite sure. There may have been one or two people in that Japanese audience. Made in Japan is the album, the song Child in Time, that could understand him. Also, the sentiment, fantastic sentiment, and the sort of thing I suppose echoed by Jeremy Corbyn earlier in part one there, which is, how do you explain to the children that we're fighting these wars? How do you explain it to them? A very, very difficult thing to do, obviously. So anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM's Politics Show, Irish, with Irish public and Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling, on Friday the 1st of October 2021. That is part two of the show now, and we'll be looking at the criminal gangs in the police first. I think maybe the place to start, Martin, is with this horrific story and the charging. And in a way, it would have been nice if Wayne Cousins had pleaded not guilty, because we'd have found a hell of a lot more about his background and what happened with the murder of Sarah Everard, wouldn't we?
Yeah, I think the most significant thing for the police is that he'd been picked up several times for sexual offences. And you have to ask the question, well, why was he still a police officer? Because if he hadn't been a police officer, he wouldn't have been able to carry out the kidnap in the way that he
did. Well, it seems pretty obvious that, that doesn't matter. If you're a sexual offender, you can keep going as a police officer. It's not a problem. He's, you know, this is the trouble, isn't it, with any kind of big organisation, is you can get to the sort of clique mentality where you're one of the boys, one of the mates, and everyone will look after each other.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is obviously an individual criminal with an individual psychopathy. But you've also got a situation when, you know, when Sir Robert Mark took over the Met years ago, he said, I've got bad news at the press conference. When he said, I've got bad news, you know, a third of my officers are criminals. I've got good news. We know who they are and we're keeping an eye on them. And of course, part of the problem is, if you've got criminal police officers, they've had police training, so they know how to protect themselves.
Yeah, Untouchables, I think, was the book, wasn't it?
Yeah, well,
Michael Gillard, yeah. And Laurie Flynn, was it? Which was actually reprinted 3 or 4 years ago as a paperback, I believe, but an absolutely brilliant expose of the massive corruption within Scotland Yard. Why is it that this is not being dealt with? I mean, that's Scotland Yard. This guy, he's obviously working for the Met, but there is this rot is nothing new. What irritates me is where somebody like Cressida Dick comes up and said, oh, well, you know, we really are sorting these problems. Of course, they're not sorting them out. The problems are getting worse. And I'm absolutely shocked and appalled that nobody, neither Priti Patel nor Cressida Dick nor any other senior officer like Neil Basu, who's the head of the anti-terrorist command, who this guy, came under. None of those three have, tendered their resignation. They're all still sitting pretty in their jobs, taking their public salaries, where obviously they're incompetent to do their job employing somebody like this. There's no guarantees that this sort of thing won't happen again if those people continue in their jobs.
Well, there's been an ongoing problem, as there is always, with police officers being corrupt. And that doesn't mean that they are psychopathic rapists like this guy, but being corrupt. And the problem is that criminals have top of their highest priority is to corrupt police officers. If you can get police officers to turn a blind eye, just like the CIA have done with the DEA and all the rest of it, you know, the drugs industry is largely orchestrated by the intelligence services. And if you're a police officer investigating that, it's more than your job's worth to stick your finger in. Now, that level of corruption is at the top. We're not just talking about low-level criminalisation of the police. We're talking about the criminalisation of the banks and the intelligence services working with the banks in order to, for example, in Afghanistan, the massive production of heroin that's gone on during the US occupation, much of it flown out of the country on US warplanes. That is the level of what you're up against if you are an honest copper.
Operation Tiberius. Now, does that ring any bells for you?
No, you're going to remind me.
Well, I did phone up the author of this article, which was in The Independent let me look and see if I can find the date here. Well, they say you've got to register if you want to find out the date of the article. That's really helpful. Thank you very much, Independent. This is an article by Tom Harper, I think this would be round about 2014, 2015, because I contacted him to see if he would mind being interviewed about the details of this very important article, I think. The article was entitled Revealed, How Gangs Use the Freemasons to Corrupt Police. Gangsters are able to recruit police officers through new secret society. Through secret society, says an investigation for specially commissioned for Scotland Yard. And Tom Harper wrote this for The Independent. As I said, secret networks of Freemasons have been used by organised crime gangs to corrupt the criminal justice system, according to a bombshell Metropolitan Police report leaked to The Independent. Operation Tiberius, which was written way back in 2002, found underworld syndicates used their contacts in the controversial Brotherhood to recruit corrupt officers inside Scotland Yard, and concluded it was one of the most corrupt aspects. In fact, the article sort of runs out. I thought I was going to be able to continue reading that, but The Independent have stopped now letting people read their articles. Anyway, very important article there. And there's a whole load of stuff to do with Freemasonry, which was being looked at the time. For example, Freemason links to the Hillsborough cover-up and policing reforms blocked by guess who? That's another Independent article, the Freemasons. Now, you know, there doesn't seem to be any evidence that Wayne Cousins was a Mason, but there's certainly, there are serious problems with the London police, Martin, aren't there? At the end of the day, though, there's been lots and lots of interesting bits of information have come out about this guy. You're right about his former sexual offences and getting off sexual offences, not being investigated for crimes that he had been committing, and yet still somehow getting through the vetting system.
Yeah, I think that's what the police have got to answer here. If he'd already flagged himself up as a sex offender, which he clearly had, he'd exposed himself in McDonald's and things like this, you'd have said, well, whatever else happens, he should no longer be a police officer.
Well, every police force has its own professional standards and professional conduct. It sounds to me as if the real criminals are within those professional conduct organisations. If police officers are not being investigated properly, police officers are getting sacked for doing their jobs, crooked and corrupt and criminal police officers are maintaining. The place to look is not whatever they are these days, the Independent Police Complaints Authority, where public are making complaints. It's their own internal conduct organisations, and there's one of these within every single police force.
Well, that's right, and this is what they've got to answer about this. This guy flagged himself up as a sex offender. Now, that should have been ringing alarm bells, and of course, if he'd been sacked from the police force, he wouldn't have had a warrant card, and he wouldn't have been able to approach this unfortunate young woman and say, I'm a police officer and I'm arresting
it's the old
under
chestnut, isn't it?
Whatever COVID they're, regulations, whatever
they're
it was
using
he did.
The secrecy that the police obviously do need to do their job properly in order to cover up criminality within the force.
Well, I think what this probably shows is that they were basically asleep on the job. They find it difficult to recruit police officers. They find it difficult to retain them. And if somebody's got what they regard as minor offences, then they say, we're not going to do anything about this.
We're about to hear from Tony Roach, who's a very good police officer, who's booted out just simply for doing his job.
Well, that's because you're dealing with you mustn't try and mix up this particular case with Everard with the wider question of criminality.
Well, it's
and
exactly the same
the
thing. I think it is the same thing, because what you've got is you've got criminals within the police who are making sure that decent coppers get the sack and criminal coppers remain in their jobs.
Yes, that's true, but that's not necessarily the case in the Everard case. He was basically had no other criminal convictions apart from sexual offences. And he was there's
I
no
that means nothing, does it?
No, it doesn't. Those sexual offences which he committed, like exposing himself
well, that's
in McDonald's,
all we know about.
Yes,
there may be more.
Yes, there may be.
And as I say, because of the way the trials run out, there may be a lot more to him.
All right. Well, anyway, the point of what you're making about criminality in the police is a very good point. But don't try and, you know, the Everard case is absolutely reprehensible, but there's no evidence that he's involved with any criminal gangs whatsoever. So that's not an issue in this case.
You know where he was working that day?
Said earlier, in the US Embassy.
In the American Embassy. So he walked straight out of the American Embassy from an armed police job in the US Embassy. One of the most sensitive relationships between Britain and the United States. And drove down the road and then decided he was going to...
Well, it may well be, Tony, that because
he would murder somebody.
If he was a trained armed officer, they're very expensive. So if he's got what they're regarded as minor sexual offences, references on his book, they may say, well, we're not just going to get rid of him because we spent all this money on him.
Exposing himself in McDonald's.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's obviously a red flag, isn't it?
Well, it should be, shouldn't it?
Obviously.
And if he'd been removed from the force at that point, he wouldn't have had a warrant card and he wouldn't have been able to do what he did.
Well, he might have, you know, photocopied it or something. Anyway, I mean, I think one of the most disturbing things is the sexual element to the crime, which was flagged up many times in his previous careers, working for the Nuclear Protection Police. So he was guarding nuclear trains. I mean, I just think this is an incredible example of absolute rot at the top. But anyway, one of the best commentators I've seen on this, well, I don't think they mentioned this whole business of him having been working that day at the US Embassy, which is in itself extremely suspicious. What was he actually doing there? Was he actually operating as a police officer? Was he doing something else? Was Professor David Wilson on, I think it was on Julia Hartley Brewer's program on Talk Radio this week, who's a criminologist. And he takes us through, this is a 6 minute, 7 minute long piece, but he takes us through what he sees as a criminologist was going on here.
A serving police officer, able to use, as it emerged yesterday, his status as a police officer in a hire car, not a police car, but to show his warrant card, to use his police issued handcuffs to pretend to arrest Sarah Everard. She was in breach of lockdown conditions, of course, on that night. She was walking back from a friend's house where she'd had dinner, which at that time was not allowed, absurdly in my view. But he was able to use that status to abduct her and to then later rape and murder her. What does motivate men like this?
And one other detail in terms of that very comprehensive introduction that you gave. Remember, he also strangles her using his police belt. Both the handcuffs and the belt are quite fetishized, I think. You're not going to be surprised if I say that what's motivating him are his sexual interests and his sexual fantasies, fantasies about having power and control. We should remember this was a man who was also jokingly nicknamed rapist by his peers and had also, in the months preceding Sarah Everard's murder, had been caught indecently exposing himself. Behaviours which I've often said, indeed, we've spoken about this on your programme before, behaviours which I believe should be taken far more seriously as indicators of future serious sexual assault as opposed to being trivialised. Yeah. But what was motivating him is quite clearly a desire for power and control and his sexual fantasies, which he wanted to make real.
I mean, you touched on that nickname, jokingly or not, the rapist. Apparently he made women feel uncomfortable that he worked with. He clearly had behaved or expressed himself in a way that made people uncomfortable. The fact that someone could have a nickname like that, even allowing for, as a guest editor today was saying, about the gallows humour of police officers. And we know some of the jokes, the sort of the tasteless jokes that people who work in the front line, whether it's, as surgeons or police officers in the army, often may not be to the taste of people sitting at home in a desk job, but actually that's not often a coping mechanism. But the concerns over this man and his safety around women had been raised, not just once, more than that. The nickname is a very big giveaway that people were sort of concerned at the very least about him, and yet nothing was done. How damaging do you think this is? I mean, you as a criminologist, you've worked with the police many times, for this man to have been not just a former police officer, but a serving police officer.
Well, it's incredibly damaging. And we've got and I know the police are looking at how he was able to become a serving police officer, the kind of vetting that was done to allow him into the Metropolitan Police. Remember, this was somebody who was also given access to firearms. He was on the diplomatic squad. He was armed in relation to those duties.
And there's a lot more vetting for those jobs. I mean, psychological vetting that goes on.
There absolutely is. And I've actually done part of the training for that particular group in the past. So, I mean, there are real questions to be asked here. But one of the things, Julia, that we should also concentrate on is because of some of the behaviours that we see Cousins engaged in, and the fact that he was 48 when he was engaging in these behaviours. These behaviours were very practiced, very controlled. Yeah. Very skilled. He did things both pre and post-mortem that suggested to me that this would not be the first time he'd behaved in this way. And therefore, there are things that the I think that have got to be looked at in relation to a timeline that Cousins can be placed in that maybe that may link him to other kinds of crimes of this kind.
That's the thing. I mean, the clearly the planning. I mean, again, I've thought not a very good police officer if he hired a car in his own name. He doesn't realise there's CCTV footage of him. I mean, he was this Clapham Common, for goodness sake. But so part of me was thinking, well, did he want to get caught because he didn't seem to take any of these measures? But then ordering on Amazon, you know, some of the items he used to dispose of her body. On one level, it almost seems like a sort of, hi, look at me. Can someone, you know, notice that I've done this? And yet there's also an element where he's obviously thought this through. And you know, what are the odds this is, as you say, what are the odds this is the first time he's done this? He's just got away with it previously.
I often find that I'm asked that question, especially about people who are serial offenders. Did they want to be caught? And in my experience, they don't want to be caught. It is simply by the stage that they are caught. They are operating in a parallel universe so that they don't really understand that their behavior is so aberrant and so obviously aberrant that they are going to draw attention to themselves and eventually be arrested. Yeah. They are simply working in a parallel universe by that stage where they see themselves as all powerful and as omnipotent, and therefore they don't expect to be caught. It's not that they want to be caught.
They just think they're perhaps too clever. Just finally, I mean, the sort of people who want to join to be police officers, I've mentioned on the show before, I've got some really, really good friends who are detectives, and ordinary rank and file police officers. And I know that their motivations, they just think they're just incredibly good people. And we can't go on a night out with them getting involved, trying to save someone, doing this or doing that. They feel they're incredibly public spirited. And I think that's the vast majority of police officers that I've come across. But we've all, have we not, come across police officers who are loving the power, who are egomaniacs, and who are loving every moment of their shiny buttons on their uniform and their authority. Do we need to be making sure that people who are perhaps just into power are not put in positions where they do have power over other people, and in this circumstance, able to use that power for such a horrible, horrible thing to do?
Like you, first of all, before answering your substantive question directly, like you, I have many friends who are serving police officers. And as you indicated, I still do quite a lot of work with the police. And I know that all of those police officers are absolutely devastated by the behavior of Cousins and the breach of trust that creates between themselves and members of the public. And the answer to your question is, of course, we have to think very carefully about who becomes a police officer. And some police officers just don't get it. If you think about the vast majority of police officers, they are white, heterosexual men. Yeah. And therefore, it does imply that we've got to think about a broader pool of people, gender in terms of ethnicity, in terms of sexualities, who start policing our streets. But again, that would go back to there are some real failings here that have to be investigated in terms of how Cousins was able to get through what should have been a pretty strict vetting procedure.
Absolutely. Professor David Wilson, always so good to talk to you, sir. Emeritus Professor of Criminology. Thank you very much indeed.
So that's Julia Hartley Brewer there talking to Professor David Wilson. I thought very, you know, interesting, a bit deeper insight. And there's also been more things emerging since Martin there. Other criminologists echoing actually what he was saying there, Professor David Wilson was saying about maybe this is not the first time that this sort of thing that Wayne Cousins had done this, that he may have killed sex workers in the past. There is some indication that may be the case as well. He may be going to Belmarsh potentially because he's considered a very dangerous guy, a highly trained killer, alongside Julian Assange. There's something a bit perverse about that, Martin.
Well, the perversity is that Assange is in Belmarsh, not that he's going there. Yes, I mean, obviously, the questions are raised. Do the police need to go back and look at unsolved murders from the past and see if Cousins fits the frame?
Obsessed with violent porn. It's now becoming clear that he was obsessed with violent pornography. That should have really flagged up some sort of problem, shouldn't it? I mean, that violent porn is illegal.
violent porn depends what violent porn you're talking about. Some porn, relatively violent porn, is not illegal. Some is illegal. Certainly child pornography is illegal, as you know, because children have to be used in the making of it. I mean, I think the fact that he basically exposed himself in McDonald's is what Sherlock Holmes would call a clue, and something should have been done about that, surely. I mean, it couldn't be clearer.
Neil Basu, he's the guy who was his line manager, if you want, the counter-terrorism command chief. He's said absolutely nothing about this. He's keeping his head down.
Well, it may well be that, the elite, as these people would perceive themselves to be...
Or the deep state, maybe?
Yeah, well, I don't... They perceive themselves to be the elite, and therefore they probably, having spent a lot of money and training on this guy, he's probably regarded as a bit of a weirdo, but he's a good shot or something like that. That presumably is the kind of thinking that's allowed this to happen. And, basically, as was being hinted in that interview... There are some people who might make very good police officers on paper in terms of, they've got all the right attitudes, reflexes, whatever, but they shouldn't be doing it because they've just got a power trip, and that's why they want to be police officers. But that's a problem, in all sorts of places.
But if one police officer's got having a power trip... Martin, if there's a whole group of police officers who are all having power trips together, there's also another officer in Norfolk who's been suspended from his job because he was sharing women hate material on WhatsApp with Wayne Cousins in the run-up to all of this. This is not just a one-off, is it? There are groups of police officers who think this is all okay. Basically, there's complete impunity for them. So when they are committing crimes, they're getting off, and when people are reporting these people to the police authorities of various sorts, whether it's outside or inside the police, it's the people who are doing the reporting that get the sack.
Well, what you've got is a culture of misogyny in uniformed services, and that's a historical thing. It goes for soldiers as well. And, soldiers are supposed to be aggressive, etc., etc., and that often turns into the fact that they actually beat up the women in their lives, for example. And are they going to be stopped being soldiers? Well, that's a question.
Okay, well, we're going to move on away from Wayne Cousins now, thank God. But we're going to hear something even more disturbing, in fact, in many ways, which is an interview I did this week with a former police officer from Cardiff called Tony Roach, R-O-A-C-H-E. Tony was sacked recently a few years ago, actually, but he's desperately trying to clear his name. He's been in a ridiculous sort of situation, and he explains to begin with, and the full interview with Tony is going to be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, what happened to him. And what it does show is that the Professional Standards Department of South Wales Police is actually a criminal gang. And that the criminal, they have actually been recruiting violent criminals to supply false and fake information to get honest police like Tony sacked.
I was coming out of a meeting, and as I'm walking towards my car in the car park, two PSD officers approached me, and I thought they wanted some intelligence or something, and they just arrested me, and I was like, what? And... of course, that was round about 20 past 12, just after midday. So I'm taking up the valleys in a police station.
Wait, were you cuffed or what?
I just can't remember. And I was just in shock, and I was taken up there. Of course, I remember I was stuck in a room by the cells, and then I remember the Police Federation, who haven't helped me at all throughout this. They contacted the solicitor, and the solicitor didn't turn up till about, 7 o'clock, half seven.
In the evening. I mean, just for people that don't know, the Police Federation is like almost like a kind of union for police officers.
Well, I wouldn't call them a union, and I'll tell you why. So anyway, I'm nearly, devastated. I don't know what's going on. The solicitor come into the room then, introduce himself. And it will stay with me for the rest of my life. I said, can you tell me what I've been arrested for? And he said, misconduct in a public office. And I must tell you, you might end up going to prison. I just broke down and I thought, what is going on here? So anyway, I was interviewed, and all these allegations, I was taking cash envelopes. I was giving information out. I answered every single thing. And anyway, I was bailed, and interviewed again. I was billed, interviewed again, and I think it was around about August, September, I was told there'd be no criminal charges against me, which I knew. But what's really obviously hurts, and I'm suffering PTSD because of all this. I've only found out October last year, because I've got disclosure and I can evidence all what I'm saying, that the South Wales Police were involved in police stings with two known criminals. I've got the one statement and it's not even signed by any police officers. There's no times, no dates. It's like somebody from a school has written a statement. It's appalling. This guy is very, very violent. He's also made threats to kill certain people, which I've had to put intelligence in. He's got access to firearms. He was supposed to have a gun in the office because a license in trade, it's very, very corrupt, as you've said. And so this guy has lied, perverted the course of justice with another guy who said that, I was taking drugs and, I was so fit. The only drug I've taken is probably paracetamol or something. I've represented the police in the Welsh League football. I've always taken pride in my health, never, ever taken any substance, never smoked in my life. So they believe these two criminals. And then I've got evidence as well to show that they've lied, they've perverted the course of justice. And then what's happened, they have put surveillance on me and my wife for 18 months. I've got evidence where they've been in my home. They've lied to go to a Cardiff magistrate to get a warrant to search our house. I've seen documentations where they've lied to get further authorizations against me. And obviously I'm trying to get my pension on ill health now. And what's more concerning, my solicitor, who used to work with the police rep, police federation, has gone separate because of the corruption involved with the police federation and also the senior officers of the police forces. And this is a national thing. We are not getting the support or the help. We get chosen who we have. So there is all this evidence come to light. I've asked the police. I've done freedom of information. One of the questions, I requested that ACC Lewis was the head of special operations. They wrote back to me, "We have consulted with our human resource department who advised ACC Lewis was substantive head of special operations, that's PSD, from the 3rd of May 2013 until the 27th of January 2014. I've got documentation where he's been involved in the surveillance as an ACC, authorising certain tactics and COVID, whatever you want to call it.
And the point being, which Tony didn't quite get a chance to finish there, is that these individuals were then in charge of his disciplinary hearing, Martin. So the people that were launching this £1 million public money investigation into an honest police officer, at least allegedly honest, are the very people that are sitting on his panel to get rid of him. I suppose the most shocking part of all of this is that you're using evidence from two known criminals who are also police informers. And they're not supposed to use criminals as police informers, by the way. And they're not allowed to in order to get this honest policeman sacked in Cardiff.
Well, it sounds like an absolute miscarriage of justice from what I've just heard there. But as you'll know, Tony, and you meant use the word alleged there earlier, it's very difficult to get to the bottom of these things.
Telling the truth, I think but most kids can recognise it.
Okay. I have no reason to doubt what he's saying. But you'll understand that if you'd interviewed the South Wales police, they may have said something different.
I can tell you what, they won't be interviewed. I bet you they won't be interviewed. They will just say, oh, we are declining to be interviewed about this topic because they don't want to be talked to anybody. I mean, we do know, we had recently the BBC a couple of weeks ago, or even last week, had a documentary about the murder of Lynette White, which the police were implicated in. And then earlier this year, we had a special programme with the family of the victims of the Cledach murders, which were also South Wales police. So anyway, I also spoke to Tony told me actually about this whole history there is with South Wales police. Of course, this is the capital of Wales, Cardiff. If there was going to be political corruption around and criminality going on at the top, at the pinnacle, then of course South Wales police would be part of that to cover up criminality, to make sure that criminal politicians, criminal financial people in Cardiff, to do with the public budget, the public money, etc., wouldn't be arrested, so that they could get off scot-free. And so Tony Roach talks about some of the other problems that there's been, miscarriages of justice in South Wales.
With this, the killing of Lynette White, the killing in the Cardiff Bay, that programme, Matt Jukes, the chief constable, said, and I was physically sick, he stated, all that happened all those years ago, it doesn't happen in my force today. What a liar. The guy has got to be transparent. He cannot ignore what we're telling him. You know, I'm a serving police officer. Now, if they've done that to their own, what are they doing to the public? And the IOPC, it's got to be disbanded. I would like an appeal against my dismissal, which I know I'm not going to get, but I'm not going to stop fighting for it, because they know it's going to expose, my story is going to be similar regarding the evidence and tampered with and refused, delayed, etc., like the Lynette White case. And South Wales Police needs to look at them. There needs to be a full public inquiry into South Wales Police, because there's a lot more to this, which obviously I don't want to say on air, but, you know, once this comes out, and this is why the IOPC do not want to investigate senior officers. You've got the South Wales Police PCC, Alan Michael. Since he's been in post, he's only recruited chief constables within, because obviously they know, you know, what's going on. And I'm sure if any chief constable came into South Wales, he'd say,
they would be horrified. I mean, the people, if he's recruiting from inside, these senior officers all know where the bodies are buried.
Exactly. And anyone working for the safest job in South Wales Police, I would say, is in professional standards. And I know a lot of these officers have been in serious trouble, and they've never, ever been charged with any offences, investigated, because, like you said, they know where all the bodies are buried.
Well, do you think it's possible for South Wales police officers to commit murder and then to just simply blame it on somebody else and get away with it?
Well, I've got to be careful what I'm saying, but what I've seen, like the Cledach, you look at the Lynette White case, my case, you know, and I'll tell you now, I've had threats as well from these two individuals who made false allegations while I was a serving police officer. In the company of one of my colleagues, I put a report in of the threats. Now, the one guy, a couple of months before, I put a report in for him to be arrested because he made threats involving live ammunition, guns, and he even put bullets on a table. And all the intelligence and South Wales Police did nothing about it. So when that individual then makes a threat to myself in front of a colleague, and then they turn on, they say, oh, we haven't got the report. Well, unfortunately, the report went via email, electronic, and they've now got it after. They had it anyway then, which, you know, for them to say we haven't got it is another lie. It's perverting the course of justice again. And I was threatened February this year by the other individual who made false allegations, and his connections and everything. You know, it's they're very, very violent, nasty people. Now, I'm not in the job now. So, yeah, I did report it, but to cover myself, but I'm on tenderhooks. I know the police are not going to do nothing to him because he's been an informant with them. And I'm looking, and I'm not sleeping, and I'm looking over my shoulder everywhere I go, and I shouldn't be, you know, sorry, I'm getting upset. I shouldn't be living like this.
So Tony Roach, PC Tony Roach, sacked by criminal police officers, employing criminals to furnish false evidence against him, and then further threatening his life. So it's not very easy for an honest cop in Cardiff, Martin.
Doesn't sound so.
There's a, as I say, there's a long record of miscarriages of justice. Anyway, so this whole idea, let's have a listen now to this, a shorter clip from Tony about the use of IOPC complaints, using these criminals as informants.
Matt Dukes, the ex-chief constable, who's now a commissioner up in the Metropolitan Police, he have stated South West Police will never use criminals as informants. And I'm thinking that was like another knife in my stomach. It's a cover-up. The IOPC, Catherine Evans, I've spoken, emailed her numerous times, and she comes back and she says, under the Police Reform Act, I cannot make a complaint. And so, you know, I'm speaking to you now, and I think one day you might remember when something might horrible have happened with me. And then people will start questioning people. But South West Police have got so many miscarriage of justice. There's another boy up in Aberdare who was, we believe, he was pushed in a river and drowned. And the parents made a complaint. And I know the South West Police said there was nothing wrong. The IOPC were happy there was nothing wrong. And I know Michael Mansfield now, as he was at the High Court, and now they're taking South West Police again to court for another miscarriage of justice.
Well, the list goes on and on of miscarriages of justice in South Wales with the crooked cops over there. I mean, there's a whole... Actually, if you sit and think it, you know, maybe you scribble it down on a piece of paper, there's only four or five specific individuals. If you can get those four or five specific people as corrupt, and maybe it is that they're being threatened and intimidated and they're making these decisions because there are threats to their lives by criminals. You know, for example, the South Wales Police Commissioner, Tony is very critical of. They're the boss of the IOPC, the Independent Office of Police Complaints, so-called independent. You know, there's only a handful of people. If they're corrupt, Martin, the whole system starts to fail and the criminals start taking over. The police become the biggest gang mafia in the country.
Well, that can happen in this country and obviously happens in other countries a lot. I mean, if you remember, the West Midlands crime squad were eventually disbanded because of all the miscarriages of justice that they were involved in, including the Birmingham Six. And now they're called West Mercia Police, because you've just changed the name completely to get away from the old name that they used to have.
Anyway, Tony's biggest beef, really, is this basic fact that his accusers were the people who were sitting on the panel deciding whether he could keep his job or not as a police officer in Cardiff, doing a very good job, by the way, in the licensing trade, getting drug dealers arrested and that sort of thing, who were operating within clubs and pubs in central Cardiff.
It seems with South Wales, if you're a senior officer, you can do what you want. It's terrible. And they will spend the public purse how they want. They will cover up. And like I said, with my case, everything I'm telling you, Tony, I can evidence. I know some people say, oh, this happened, that happened. I can evidence every single thing. And is more, which obviously we won't have enough time. But if you've seen the evidence I've got, it is shocking. It is like it's a massive miscarriage of justice. The way they deal with the evidence, and they lose it, dispose of it. And like I said, I've got evidence now, 6 years later, which I requested my misconduct. But what done it for me as well, more importantly, you've got the ACC, Richard Lewis and Gary Osborne, who were involved in the investigation. How can they sit and chair my misconduct panel? I was always proud of a police officer. I had excellent reputation, and it's not sour grapes. This is why I've been fighting for 6 years, because I cannot accept corruption. People used to say to me, you South Wales police officers, you're corrupt. And I used to think, oh, it's because obviously you've punched him or you've done a burglary or whatever. I tell you what, it's opened my eyes. They are corrupt. and I can evidence the corruption, and it all stems from the Salt Waste Police Crime Commissioner, Alan Michael, and the chief senior officers. And I can evidence all this myself. You trying to take them on, they will just all close ranks.
And continue the criminality going on within South Wales Police. You know, I think the first time we came across allegations about criminality in the senior ranks of South Wales Police was good old Maurice Kirk, the flying vet. Do you remember we used to get clips from him from time to time? And the, I mean, he was a marked man by them because he owned a business, actually owned a building, and one of the tenants was a son of one of the superintendents at South Wales Police. And this son of the one of the police superintendents at South Wales Police was dealing drugs from the flat. And so Morris, stupidly, decided to terminate this person's contract and get a different tenant in. And they were not happy. He made it clear to him it was because he knew he was doing drug dealing. And then he was targeted by South Wales Police. So there is a rather nasty pattern developing here. And I think it's also going on in London, Martin, because these capital cities are where all the political power and the financial power of, you know, public money is concentrated.
Well, that's not, that could be so, but it's also,
I think it is so. I think it's pretty clear. And also,
well, the Police Service of Northern Ireland, the RUC, murdered loads of people. And there's lots of stuff.
Well, this
been
is, we're talking
up.
About the troubles in the 1990s. We're talking about here is going on today.
Yes.
In South Wales, in Cardiff. We're not talking about 1980.
I'm just saying, don't presume that all criminality is found in Cardiff or in London.
Who said that? Well, I didn't say it. I think the corruption is concentrated where the political power and the public money is based and where those decisions are being made.
It's going to be concentrated in where the money is, for sure. Mm. And there's plenty of places. Anyway, Birmingham's a big place as well, as we mentioned
there
earlier.
There was Tony Roach, R-O-A-C-H-E. I'll put the full interview with him up on our show page at thisweek.org. UK, and I think it's particularly interesting that this whole thing started with the investigation of the licensing trade, that is to say nightclubs and pubs that were doing drug dealing, and he managed to stop that. Now, we in Bristol have got clubs where young people have died because of the drug dealers, so maybe we could do with some police that are prepared to stand up here in Bristol to some of those drug deals going on in those nightclubs to stop those kids dying. One of the things I've heard, and I don't know if you've heard this, Martin, I mean, I don't really go to nightclubs much myself, but nowadays, you know, you're sometimes searched for drugs on the way in, and then when you get in there, they've got a house dealer.
It's normal practice, Tony. We need to legalise all drugs. I was talking earlier about the CIA's involvement in cocaine training and what's happened in Afghanistan, yeah? The whole of the international drugs industry is an engine of corruption at every level, from nightclubs in Bristol to what goes on in Mexico on the border. And something needs to be done about it. And we're trying to hold back the tide.
Well, this is
and
actually prohibition, isn't it? It's just like what happened in the United States
alcohol. It's on a much bigger scale.
Yeah.
And therefore, the money involved is much more enormous. And of course, it's got the intelligence agencies and the military involved in it.
Is there any political will to bite that bullet, the illegalization
of
drugs?
Well, in Mexico itself, there's something coming through the Congress to legalize marijuana, and there are other people saying and this has happened also in Colombia. People are saying we need to legalize.
I suppose there's
drugs.
Too much funny money comes through it, and the banks, of course. Remember because that whole business of HSBC accepting suitcases, actually adapting their branches so that people could stick suitcases.
And in 2008, when the banks collapsed.
So the banks are ultimately at the bottom of this, really, aren't they?
Well, yeah, but also the intelligence services who work through the banks, the CIA and MI6, are the biggest drug dealers on the planet. But they are the controllers of the whole thing. Afghanistan has been become the main source of heroin in the world. It used to be Laos, Cambodia, when that was all set up by the CIA in the Vietnam War.
Hopefully
era.
The Taliban will be able to put it back to where it was when the Americans turned up, which was virtually zero.
They did that in order to try and, you know, win brownie points with the West, but it didn't do them any good.
You know what's going to happen is their whole economy is going to go down the tubes now because
that's
of their
right.
money.
They're going to
the
be
heroin
punished.
Money is going to be.
Well, the thing is that the Taliban will be able to. What the Taliban will do is they will allow it to operate until they're given an incentive not to allow it to operate. They've basically, the view they took during the insurgency was that we are going to, you know, if we're going to allow drug dealing because we got to, you know, that's a source of funds for our resistance campaign.
Anyway, whilst we're staying in South Wales, we'll be hearing now from Ligia Voica, who's a nurse who's been working in South Wales, in Barry, actually, and she's now been taken off of her job. But she talked to me this week about rather hideous. I mean, this is the sort of thing that can begin to thrive when you've got corrupt police forces. This is what she calls, and many people apparently who work for this business, called the Barry Mafia. Now, these are people who work for something called DEME, which is spelt D-E-M-E. It's part of something called New Waves Solutions. And this is the company that's involved in the dredging of out for the Hinkley Power Station. Now, it comes as a bit of a surprise that such a neutral organisation like this should allow sexual harassment of its staff. But anyway, that's what Ligia has been alleging. And this is what she says was alleged sexual assault on her. And the way that the manager involved then managed to squeeze her out of the business and made her life very difficult because she wouldn't submit to his sexual advances. Obviously, in South Wales Police, you might be thinking twice about whether there's any point in reporting it to corrupt police officers to investigate something like this. But anyway, let's Ligia tell part of her tale. The full tale will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later.
Europe Championship, do you remember the match? I don't know, a few months ago. So she asked me, she told
me that
she
happened in June, July this year, and she's talking about the Euros.
Online induction for the crew. And I said, okay, you can come to my office to bring the tablet. And he mentioned that he watching the football. I said, okay, on the way to my room, I will bring the tablets to you. So he invited me. We had a chat. The football was finished, but the ceremony continues. So he touched me, and obviously, rejected him, and then he tried to kiss me, and I left the room in that time. Then the nightmare began. My nightmare started after all this. So the first thing he did was to employ a third nurse. I don't know how he justified this with his superiors as Balfour Beattie's, because everyone worked back to back. However, my first colleague, Juliet, brought her good friend. So, with 1 year experience as a nurse who was totally unsuitable for this kind of work, she was unable to take proper medical decision in an emergency, you know. Then, during my holiday, because I rented another house, I had to open my business email where I had my timesheet to prove that I was working. So, I noticed Chris Holden was housing in a hotel an infected person with COVID. Instead of transferring the person immediately to the safe house, we have an allocated home for this type of situation. We don't keep the infected person there because the hotel is not suitable for this. The windows are not opening. They don't have balconies. If the person is a smoker, it's can you imagine? He can't go downstairs. He can't open a window. So I call him immediately, and I ask him what is going there. Oh, and he started to shout at me. And 1 week later, when I needed the email address for a recommendation in order to rent a house, I noticed he had changed the password. The password was changed only for me, not for the other two colleagues. Then another thing, following that rejection, was that Chris changed the terms of working. He told me that if I wanted to continue working, I had to choose between working 2 weeks, being off 4 weeks, or 3 weeks working and 6 weeks off. I told him it was wrong to do this. Who can afford to stay 6 weeks without money? But he stressed that if I didn't accept these conditions, I'm free to go. So I understood he was trying to get rid of me, and I accepted to work 3 weeks on, 6 weeks off. Then when I started the last rotation, the third in September, in a first day, he told me that next day I would be asked during the daily meeting if I would agree, with a shorter quarantine in the hotel, because the offshore team wanted this. I said, yes, agree, because from medical and legal point of view, they are covered. He told me he had another opinion. So, yes, the result was that I was obstructed. The next day, he didn't send me the invitation for the meeting. It's a daily meeting every morning with all the managers when we discuss different problems. It was so, this shocked me. And Chris, additionally, Chris brought an administrative support for me, and I was very happy because I used to work 15, 16, sometimes 18 hours a day. Next day, I realized the catastrophe. He said Kim Farley, a sister of health and safety staff in a Bari office, Kim Farley is my administrative boss, and I have to stay away as much as possible from the administrative duties. And she deleted important messages. She created 42 folders where she filed the emails. Even I hadn't time to read the emails, you know. So she created even a folder with my name where she filed the emails which she considered that I have to read them. So usually at 9:30 in the morning, my inbox was empty. She treated me so bossily. She frequently shouted at me. And when I complained, Chris Holden said, you need someone to be bossy with you, Lygia. And I said, really? What kind of manager you are?
So that's the voice of Lygia Voica, a Romanian lady who's been working as a nurse for this company, DEME, D-E-M-E, a Belgian firm, who are part of the Hinkley Point Construction, Balfour Beatty are the contractors, as well as the people who are doing this dredging. So I think we can safely say, so Balfour Beatty are the big guys. New Wave Solutions, they're the people who are doing the offshore work, that is to do with these dredging boats that are picking up mud from the middle of the Bristol Channel and dumping it over in Cardiff, some people believe is radioactive mud. And I mean, these are just allegations at the moment, Martin, because Lygia is going to be doing some sort of employment tribunal, some legal pursuing this. But it is pretty worrying to think that this Barry mafia can simply do what they like. And she's saying that this is the sort of thing that used to happen sometimes over in Romania, but she didn't expect that sort of thing to be going on such an important major business contract like Hinkley Sea here in the UK.
Well, we all know that the balance of power in the workplace has shifted dramatically against the individual worker. And, of course, there's always been bad behaviour by managers. And, you know, but going to an employment tribunal, even if you win, is no real compensation for being treated like that, is it?
Not at all. And it's actually, you know, that's a sexual assault. It sounds to me as if she's been saying so. Anyway, alleged sexual assault. But here she is again, a final clip from her. And you can hear the full interview with Lygia Voica on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. Quite a few interviews this week. Where she talks about what she describes as the Barry, or others describe as the Barry Mafia.
When I noticed the first actions, I called not the line, obviously. I couldn't complain to my line manager. Chris was one of them. The other one supported me. He tried to help me, but he hadn't enough power. The rumor said that Chris Holden is supported by a higher manager being DEME staff, but the headquarters are in Belgium, you know. So I complained to the next level, so they knew about all of this. I started to complain in May, in April, May, when I noticed what happened. And they, since May, they didn't take, they took just a few actions properly, you know. So when the other manager came, he tried to sort the things. But when Chris Holden came back, he destroyed everything. So, yes, looks like a scheme there. Like, in fact, the guys on the vessels, the offshore team, used to call Barry office staff Barry Mafia or Barry's clan. So I didn't know. They told me, oh, you didn't know. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I have to laugh, but it isn't really very funny, is it? That the how are you now anyway, and how are you getting on?
Well, I told you I was shocked initially because I didn't expect to find something like that here, and especially in a business.
Yeah, so big business doing this sort of thing, Martin. Anyway, it'll be interesting to see how she gets on. Apparently she's going to be going back to work for them again in a couple of months' time. So if she doesn't pursue the legal methods, it'd be very interesting to see how she's received when she returns to work after she's been... I mean, effectively, all this stuff is constructive dismissal, isn't it? The idea that your emails are being looked at by someone else and filtered out so that you're getting into trouble because you're not actually able to read your own emails.
Well, I mean, I could tell you personal experiences of management acting like that. I won't bother because, you know, there's too much to, you know, virtually everybody has had some kind of experience of this in their working lives. That's one of the reasons why we need stronger trade unions.
Yeah, quite right. Okay, so like I say, the story, the incredible tale of Lygia Voica will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later, but we'll finish tonight with Dr. David Shime. And this is the big shocking for me, really shocking COVID story I've seen this week, which is about the censorship of a guy called Juan Chamis. Juan Chamis is, I believe, based in the United States, but he's originally, I think, from South America. He's been doing very detailed data analysis from Peru. And Peru, it seems, well, it doesn't seem, he's proved it, as showing an incredibly good results from in cities where ivermectin has been being used. In fact, you know, you're looking at something like 75% of people recovering who would have otherwise died if they're treated with ivermectin. And it's a very good way of stopping people with COVID actually ending up in hospital. Now, the key to all of this is understanding that legally, the emergency use authorizations of these megabucks vaccines, which Bill Gates and the big pharmaceutical industry chums are hoping to create, this $200 billion annual industry, injecting everyone in the world with a COVID vaccine. There is only one slight problem, is that the emergency use authorization for these experimental vaccines, which, by the way, finished their trials, folks, in 2023, 2 years' time, is that there must be no alternative treatment. Well, there is an alternative treatment. It's absolutely clear, crystal clear to the doctors and to anybody that really looks into it, and it's called ivermectin. I mean, there are others, including chloroquine, which can be effective, but ivermectin shows the very best results if it's given to people as soon as they catch, I believe, even the flu, but certainly COVID-19. So anyway, let's have a listen now to the incredible results that have been going on in Peru that Twitter this week have seen fit to destroy. Actually smash all these figures and this good news about ivermectin and to close Juan Chamis's account.
The mass distribution of ivermectin for COVID-19 treatment was authorized by government decree in Peru on May 8th, 2020. Following that, the 25 states of Peru independently conducted mass distributions of ivermectin for inpatient and outpatient treatments of COVID, each autonomously, each in different time frames. Now, 24 of these states conducted these mass ivermectin treatments early in the first waves of the pandemic, beginning in April, while Lima delayed treatments by 4 months until August. So in the early period, Lima serves as a control group. These 25 states span terrain from jungle to desert to mountain, and Peru is equivalent to an area from Florida to Minnesota to New York in the United States, or in Europe, from Denmark to Italy and Greece, with a combined total population of 33 million. We have, in effect, 25 different studies of ivermectin treatments in different large populations. This study was conducted using official health data from the government of Peru. Specifically, we used independently tracked data for COVID-19 case fatalities and also for excess deaths. We did not analyze COVID-19 case incidents because that is highly unreliable across a national population, as detailed in this paper. Now, I want to just show the graph here to the upper left shows the sharp drop in mortality after peak deaths in 8 of the 24 states of Peru with early ivermectin treatment. The red shows Lima, which delayed treatment by 4 months until finally the treatment happened and it dropped off to the right. The upper right shows independent but parallel data for COVID-19 case fatalities. We then extended our analysis to all 25 states of Peru. For 24 of the states with early ivermectin treatment, excess deaths dropped 59% at 30 days after peak deaths and 75% at 45 days after the day of peak deaths. But for Lima, these drops up at 30 and 45 days were each just 25%. Case fatalities likewise dropped sharply in all states but Lima, yet 6 indices of Google tracked community mobility data rose over the same period. Now let's look at figure 1D. This is the most striking feature of the analysis. For 9 states having mass distributions of ivermectin in a short time frame through a national program, Operation MOT, excess deaths at plus 30 days dropped by a population weighted mean of 74%. Each drop beginning within 11 days after MOT start.
We use most recent population census to get the number of people over 60 in every one of the 25 states of Peru. And we also obtain from Peru databases of COVID of testing. We have databases of even ivermectin acquisitions and ivermectin distribution from the central government to the different states. So the data is, we have all the data possible to prove that, like, our research is well funded. We obtain information about ivermectin distribution from public reports given by governors and mayors in different places in Peru, and also large independent campaigns widely reported by the press in Peru. And also the outstanding MOT, the Mega Operación Taita, with extended coverage from government agencies and also from the media. We also use external data sources. We use the mobility reports from Google and the population densities from the Urban Center of Databases from the European Commission. We have a robust appendix with more than 150 references in the study and in the supplementary data. I think it's very important, it's crucial to state here that all this overwhelming data that we use for this paper is public. Anyone can access it and corroborate the data and our findings. Yeah, it's very concerning. You can see now the increases in deaths, but not everywhere. The places where they know, like Iquitos or Ucayali or Tumbes, they know that ivermectin works. So there is no increase, zero increase in deaths. But in Lima, they are almost the same as the highest peak. So it's not like ivermectin is not working or there is a new strain. It's just places where they use ivermectin, they are not dead.
Well, an incredible story from Peru there. And Juan Chamis was the voice you heard at the end there. He's just been deleted from Twitter completely. All of his information, the graphs that he's been supplying for the last 18 months or so, destroyed by good old Twitter. And funnily enough, I came across a story this week, Martin, that says that one of the software engineers at Twitter is actually Dr. Fauci's daughter.
Well, as you know, Twitter is a private organisation and they can ban anything they like, just like the Daily Mail. So that's the issue there. I heard all of that. I'm interested to hear any evidence. Let's hear what it is. But you will remember you came in the other week with the Economist's assessment of excess deaths in the world, and Peru came out at the top. And I was reading in The Guardian this week that they were saying, well, there's been ivermectin used in Peru widely, as we've just heard, but they've had the highest death rate per population of anybody, according to The Economist, which you were quoting the other week.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it?
It is interesting.
What's going on there?
Well, what is going on there is a good question, isn't it?
Well, who do you trust? Do you trust this deleted statistician or The Economist, I suppose?
Well, I think there is wide understanding that Peru has had the worst COVID outbreak in the whole of Latin America.
Well, wide understanding in The Economist anyway. Anyway, the guy who was giving the introduction there is Dr. David Scheim, and that is one of the, I think it's a brilliant thing. I don't catch it every week. It's the FLCCC, Frontline COVID Coalition, Care Coalition doctors. And there's also Scott Mitchell has just resigned. He's one of those doctors on that group who we've interviewed a couple of times from Guernsey. And he is in the local Guernsey papers this week. He's given up his job. He said the idea of vaccinating children is just too much for him to take. The idea that he has got to vaccinate children that want to be vaccinated, he doesn't want to do it. So he's given up his job completely. He's probably going to return to his native Scotland. Let's see. Anyway, as usual, the plandemic goes on and the problems with the COVID go on, and the absolute refusal of the authorities to, and the media, most importantly, I suppose, the media, to really look into this. I think maybe we just finish on this, Martin, there's an incredible story in the Press Gazette this week about the amount of money, roughly £1 billion now, Google and Facebook are now paying to British news companies in order to have influence over the news. I mean, yeah, this is what's happening. The other thing is that they're also doing services where they actually write the news. Google will write the news for you and pretend to be, using artificial intelligence of some sort, a journalist.
Well, Google and Twitter, as I said before, are private organisations. We need to nationalise them and put some rules in place, don't we? Or we could just have all private organisations regulated, which means the Daily Mail would have to give Jeremy Corbyn a fair go. And so this show, presumably. But that's not the way the world works, is it?
It's money that seems to buy up all this stuff. What about the BBC, though? Because the BBC just this week have got given given Tim Davey, the guy from Coca-Cola, who's now in charge of the corporation's editorial policy, he's just given himself a £75,000 pay rise.
Well, the BBC do have some obligations to balance and so forth. But, of course,
do they?
Well, they do. It's in the charter. Hmm. They don't necessarily fulfil them, but they're there. I mean, but of
they
course
only seem to react to complaints if it's somebody that's a national newspaper columnist that makes that complaint.
Well, the point is that the BBC is in the sights of the Tory government, the Murdoch press, etc. And in actual fact, the BBC, for all of its failings, is far superior to any of those organisations. Now, this is a wider question about what is press freedom. We were talking about the English Civil War earlier, whatever you want to call it. And in actual fact, the pamphleteers, basically, or what, on either side, produced loads and loads of stuff that was absolutely partisan. There was no attempt by the Royalist press to give the parliamentarians a fair go, or vice versa. And that was freedom of speech of a kind. The same thing happened in the American Revolution, same thing happened in the French Revolution. Now, is freedom of speech just everybody shouting at the top of their voices, or are there some rules and regulations?
Okay, just quickly to go back to the Press Gazette story about the Google payments of a billion to big news organisations. There's been an investigation by the Press Gazette into that. journalist is, I'm just scrolling down, William Turville, over in the US, looking into this. He's discovered details of the formula Google uses to calculate individual news showcase payments. So Google are basically paying all these big news organizations and have come to various deals with them so that they can regurgitate their news content. The value of several individual contracts signed by publishers in different countries. There's evidence that publishers in Australia, where the political pressure is highest, are receiving more favorable offers than news companies in bigger countries. There are also claims that Google is preparing to delay the launch of its news showcase series in the US as publishers are pushing for greater payments and concerns that it's not working as well as a product, generating only dribbles of traffic for news websites. So people are, you know, these various news organizations are being paid by Google to use their content. But the thing is, of course, that Google then decides what priority to give that. And so when you're looking at Google News, what you're looking at is the people with the biggest amount of money. They will have the headlines at the top.
So all this idea of the internet being an absolutely free space where anybody can say anything and communicate turns out to be a load of rubbish.
It certainly does, and Julian Assange will attest to that, Martin, too. Time to sign off now, thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like to be included on my weekly email circulation list. Get in touch with me, Tony, at cultureshop.org.uk. You'll find Not the BCFM Politics Show podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details. Do please send me interviews, story tips, etc. via thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Next week, we're planning to do a, well, I am planning to do a climate change special. Is it really man-made? And a little look back a couple of years ago, actually, to a debate we did with about that very topic with Piers Corbyn, and also some of the documentaries that have been produced on the subject. I'm certainly very sceptical about whether climate change is entirely man-made. My book, after 30 years of research into the dodgiest ever deals done at the Allies and the Nazis in the last 8 months of World War II, the book's called The Traitors of Arnhem. The other one is a 300-page anthology of secret governments since the English Civil War. Both of them are available via www.bilderberg.org, and also you can go to thisweek.org.uk, the show page for this show, and find links to the books there. The long one, which is the anthology of secret government, is £20, and The Traitors of Arnhem, all about the dodgy deals at the end of the war, is £15. I think most of the links to actually buy physical books are via eBay. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream, except when we're restreaming the Richie Allen show. And over Sunday lunch at camberleysradioqk.com, you'll hear us too. Please do make live recordings and restream. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft in Bristol and at radioqk.com in Camberley, Surrey. Censorship and self-censorship of life-saving information is the norm, I'm afraid, in Britain today, thanks to the Nazi collaborators who own the transmitters and the printing presses, the glorious Fourth Reich. So if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and we'll credit you here. How many people this week are doing the story about Keir Starmer using a Nazi slogan in his speech? Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
George's Hill, a ragged bandy called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws, they were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. We come in peace, they said, to dig and sow. We come to work the lands in common and to make the wasteland grow. This earth divided, we will make whole, so it can be a common treasury for all. The sin of property we do disdain. No one has any right to buy and sell the earth for private gain. By theft and murder they took the land,
Now everywhere the walls rise up at their command. They make the laws, the chain as well. The clergy dazzle us for heaven, or they damn us into hell. We will not worship the God they serve, the God of greed who feeds the rich while poor men starve. We work, we eat together, we need no swords. We will not bow to masters or pay rent to the lords. We are free men, though we are poor. You diggers all stand up for glory, stand up now. From the men of poverty, the orders came. I sent the hired men and troopers to wipe out the diggers' claim, tear down their cottages, destroy their corn. They were dispersed, only the vision lingers on. Your poor take courage, your rich take care. The earth was made a common treasury for everyone to share. All things in common, all people one. We come in peace, the order came to cut them down.